You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
This week on Talk Nation Radio, climate chaos and militarism. We are joined by Nick Buxton, who is the co-editor of an important book called The Secure and the Dispossessed, How the Military and Corporations Are Seeking to Shape a Climate-Changed World. Nick Buxton is a communications consultant working as a publications editor and supporting online learning and supportive activist scholar communities for Transnational Institute. He works actively on issues of climate change, militarism, and economic justice, all of which show up in this book. He has been based in California since 2008 and prior to that lived in Bolivia for 4 years. Nick Buxton, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thanks, David. Thanks for having me on.
Tell us how this book came about and what it deals with.
Well, back in 2009, I was actually working, I was living in Bolivia, and I went to the climate, the big Copenhagen climate talks, which there's a lot of expectation was going to deliver. And I was actually part of the Bolivian government delegation. And now Bolivia is one of those countries which is really on the forefront of climate change. The city I lived in, La Paz, gets about 20 to 30% of its water from glaciers, which are almost completely disappearing. So here you have one of the poorest countries in South America suffering the most from climate change, and yet one of the least responsible for causing it. And one of the things that I could see as I was part of that talk is there was quite clearly an attempt by all the rich industrialized countries to have great speeches on climate change, but actually to do very little. But I started to think, well, these aren't people who are climate deniers in the kind of Trumpian model. These are people who say climate change is the real threat and yet are proposing to do nothing about it. What are they actually planning for the consequences that are clearly going to come from climate change? And that's when I started to talk to security analysts, and they say, well, actually, the military has been long planning for climate change impacts. And so have some of the biggest corporations. They have models. They do scenario planning for what will happen as climate change impacts start to hit us ever more severely. So I started to look into that and started to pull together a team of people to look at what this would mean in terms of food, what this would mean in terms of water, and who are the kind of key players who are preparing, what their plans are. And are they the sort of future that we want?
We often hear from good, well-intended people who care about the natural environment that the U.S. military takes climate change seriously, as if that is entirely a good thing. Are there not some downsides to that?
Definitely. I mean, I think it's of course, at the moment, what we have is we have this bizarre situation where one of the largest world economy and one of the most powerful nations is not even prepared to believe its own scientists. And in that situation, it's suddenly the only actual people inside Trump's cabinet who actually seem to take climate change seriously are the military. Mattis, the defense secretary, apparently, well, he in his when they were doing the speeches to kind of verify his appointment, was quite clear saying that climate change is a security threat. So that meant that a whole group of people, whether it's Democrats or whether it's environmental organizations, have said, you know, well, at least the military is talking about it and has kind of allied themselves with the military, saying, you know, here are the adults in the rooms, we always hear them referred to, and they're not pretending that climate change isn't an issue. I think my concern, really, and one that we study in the book, is that you have to think, what are their interests? And really the big question comes up is whose security? And when you look at military planning documents and why they take climate change seriously, the first is that these are hard-nosed people. They're planning, making military plans. They're going to base things on science and facts. But their real underlying thing is, how do we maintain operational effectiveness? So the reason why they are really concerned about climate change is because the U.S. has about 1,700 facilities in coastal areas, and some of those are starting to be flooded. So Hampton Roads, Virginia, one of the biggest kind of military hubs in the whole planet, is frequently getting sea surges now. So they can't ignore climate change. That's affecting their military effectiveness. Similarly, when they start talking about green fuels or solar power, it's because the US has already been really stung. In Iraq, for example, its dependence on fossil fuel, and in Afghanistan, made it very vulnerable to attacks from guerrilla forces because they could attack the convoys and therefore undermine the military machine. But those are very much kind of military concerns. And what they never do, if you look at their plans, is really look at the causes of climate change and how to tackle that. Nor are they primarily concerned with protecting the most vulnerable. So in terms of the causes of climate change, they ignore quite blatantly the fact that the U.S. is the Pentagon is the single largest organizational user of petroleum in the world. Having over 800 bases overseas and a huge military bootprint, as they call it, is both very costly but also very polluting. And so they bear a huge responsibility for the crisis. And when you look at their plans, they're also not looking at saying, how do we protect those who will be most affected by climate change? The military plans talk about how we defend economically high active areas, which means areas where there are large corporations. How do we maintain sea routes at times of instability? So it's very much about keeping the current system of where wealth is very concentrated in a few hands running. It's not about saying who will be most affected by climate change and how do we make sure we both prepare people and protect them. And that's why I think it's a dangerous thing just to suddenly say, you know, because they're the adults in the room, they're the ones you want to get into bed with.
Indeed. And they don't, there's a problem, isn't there, already when they've said it's a security threat, because they haven't said that climate change is a threat to ecosystems or a threat to humanity, or they've said it's a security threat, meaning an opportunity for militarism. Isn't that what it means?
Yeah, security is one of those very, if you ever hear the word security in national discussions, you have to ask lots of questions, because the security, it's always dovetailed that security, national security is something that benefits all. And actually, if we think, most people, when they think about security, they mean, have I got a job? Have I got a roof over my head? Have I got security in my neighborhood from crime? But it's dovetailed suddenly into national security, which is maintaining a large U.S. imperial presence across the world, one of the largest military budgets that dwarfs any other nation. I mean, the U.S. military spending is equal to the next equivalent of 10 countries. And it's a huge diversion of resources. So, of course, when you're diverting money towards supporting this kind of huge military presence, you're also diverting exactly the kind of money that we need to prepare for it. Even when the military starts to kind of paint itself in great colors around humanitarian aid, it's hugely expensive. You know, it cost, in Haiti in 2010, the U.S. was spending just $70 million in just a few weeks to operate one aircraft carrier. That same money, $70 million in Haiti, could have had a huge impact in terms of its reconstruction. So it's also a very expensive presence, even when they do deploy a little bit of their efforts to doing good things, which is a tiny part of what they do.
Indeed. We're speaking with Nick Buxton. The book is The Secure and the Dispossessed, How the Military and Corporations Are Seeking to Shape a Climate-Changed World. Talk a little bit, Nick, about something that's in the book, the practice of greenwashing. It seems that some people have been very intentionally sold on the idea that the U.S. military and Walmart and ExxonMobil and other corporations have gone green. What are the facts of the matter?
Well, it's always been the case that, and we see this with, and that's one of the reasons why the military has, particularly under the Obama era, was quite happy to embrace climate change and the fact that they were taking it seriously as part of their mission. Anyone who joins up to either the military or becomes a member of the corporation likes to feel that they're part of something good. So companies or the military have always painted for the military in their advertising will always emphasize their humanitarian aspect. Companies will always say they're doing something good for the planet because that's part of it's an important part of their recruitment. But it's also part of their reputation and maintain, and in a sense, putting off people shining an effective spotlight on what they're doing. So what often happens is most perversely is that those who are most destructive and having the most impact in terms of climate change are the ones who have the biggest and smartest and most well-paid PR campaigns to say they're doing the most. So in terms of some of the biggest corporations like Walmart or ExxonMobil, both of whom are very much part of a high-polluting, high-carbon-intensive industrial model, they're the ones who have most of the adverts making themselves out as kind of green heroes and green saviors. In some places, it gets really perverse in terms of military companies. And back in 2006, the British Aerospace, one of the biggest British arms dealer, did a whole presentation that it was going to go green and was going to produce environmentally friendly weapons. It would have kind of reduced lead bullets. Or you would have, they were offering also kind of rockets which produce less toxins. And I mean, this was going to absurd length because the fact is that they were still ultimately instruments of death, but they were suddenly being painted with this green gloss. And so it can get quite perverse, but I think the big issue is that when you see greenwashing, it's really about kind of distracting people from effective practices. And it sometimes is swallowed far too effectively. Walmart did a huge campaign when it was kind of losing its market share and starting to suffer. It launched a very successful PR campaign that Walmart was going to go green, that it was going to produce renewable energy. You're going to have solar panels on all their warehouses. They were going to reduce waste. And they got a huge amount of free publicity from their announcements. But when you looked at it about 6 or 7 years later, when they looked into it, actually you found out that their 100% renewable energy goal in about 6 years has only led to 2% of them producing their energy. And many of the other goals were just kind of lauded goals, but actually when you delved into it, were making very little progress. And they also distract from the fact that a company like Walmart, its very model is predicated on monocrops in cheap goods and industrialized globalized growth, which actually is worsening the situation of climate change. So it's a very effective distraction tactic, but we should treat it as such.
In the discussion of this in the book, there was a product I think I heard of for the first time in your book called reputational risk insurance. What is that?
There is a chapter there that looks at kind of how the different corporate sectors are preparing for climate change impacts. And what you see in all of that is that they also have a language of security. And that was interesting to us. It was at the same time as the military was talking about climate change becoming a security threat, you also had corporations speaking in a very similar language. They tended to use words more like risk. And so you have corporations are also worried about climate change, primarily from a security risk angle. They're thinking, how does this affect my operations? So for example, Abercrombie and Fitch, the retailers here suffered during Hurricane Sandy when some of its when both warehouses were flooded and some of its stores had to be closed and so on. So they think, how do we deal with climate change and can keep our operations running and reduce the dangers to loss of income? But they're also looking at the kind of risks that could come as there's instability and but they're also looking really at reputation. You know, how do we, as climate change has more of an impact, as people expect us to do things, to be responsible global actors, what are the risks to our reputation? And that's why you get so many companies involved in greenwashing. It's really a kind of a way of saying we're good global actors, we're good global citizens, you shouldn't criticize us. And reputational risk insurance is actually one of the products that was offered. Everything like this can be turned into a market in the end. And what we've discovered with insurance is that it's rather like the banking sector. You have companies can get insured, and then those who are insuring companies or houses then get reinsured by others, and then you can start to sell those reinsurance products on the market at higher rates. And one of the things they started to offer was also reputational risk. So BP, after the oil spill in the Gulf, led to a whole bunch of products being offered for companies to say you can have your reputation insured for the risks that you might take from being involved in damaging destructive products. How do you protect your kind of share price and the risks that come from kind of dangerous and destructive practices? So it's part of our globalized, financialized world that everything, even the most destructive practices, can be turned into a financial product that can then be sold on the market.
It really seems that public relations and profiteering are given more priority than mitigating the damage or preventing the damage of climate change. In the book, you talk about UK representatives at the European Union suggesting that rescuing drowning refugees from the Mediterranean would only encourage more refugees rather than refugee aid. The biggest industry to have grown out of the recent crises of mass fleeing from Western-driven and armed wars has been border walls and fences and guards and weapons. Are we putting more energy into making ourselves feel better and protecting rich people than into solving the problem?
Well, that's the premise of the book, really, is that we are in a situation where climate change is going to... It's clearly going to have impact. We know that it's already having an impact. We see it in the extreme weather conditions we've experienced in the U.S., whether it's the major drought in California or the flooding that's happened in Puerto Rico and Houston. But we see it in much less reported, of course, all the time in many other countries. At the same time, there's been a drought here. There's been a very serious drought in Bolivia, but that's almost net. I'm sure that's got almost 0.001% coverage in the US media. So it's a situation that we wanted to raise. It's like who, in a situation of increased instability and also in terms of increased climate impact, who are we putting in charge of the future? And should it be those who are most responsible for the crisis? Corporations, if you look at it, actually 90 corporations have created more than two-thirds of all the global emissions since industrialization. So you're actually not talking, we treat this as a problem for everyone, but actually it's a few small corporations who produce vast amounts of emissions. Similarly, the Pentagon being the single largest user. So do we want to turn to them for our security in a climate change world, and whose security will they be really providing? And that's really the danger. We see this world being created of the secure and the dispossessed. In Europe, we did some further research really looking at the whole build-up of the border wars, because one of the things you get as promised as security through a kind of militarized model is the kind of promise that Trump makes. You know, if we have more people having to leave their countries or having to move because of climate problems, the solution is putting up walls. And he mainly deploys it against terrorists, but it's also, you'll see it in many military documents, that actually their big specter that they're warning about is refugees, climate refugees, that we're going to have to protect against.
So what should
we
be doing?
But then if you look into actually who's involved, what you see is that there's a small number of people, mainly arms companies, who are now moving into the homeland security market, and they're making huge amounts of money. And the perverse thing we found in Europe was that some of the biggest arms sellers in the Middle East and North Africa, so the ones causing a lot of the fueling a lot of the conflicts in that region, are now some of the biggest winners of EU border contracts to build the walls, to build the robots, to build all the security prevention measures that are being built on the European border. So they're both causing the crisis, and then they're reaping the rewards. And, of course, the people who are suffering the process and those are the thousands and thousands who currently lose their lives in the Mediterranean just trying to get to safety.
So there's little more horrendous and horrific than that. But what should we be doing? What should our approach be to looming climate chaos?
Well, that's what we did look at in the chapter, is that it can be deeply depressing if you see some of the plans being made at the moment. But actually, what you see on the ground is a very different picture. And really, what we're posed with is the choice. If we're going to be, as we face climate impacts, we have to ask if we're not going to put our faith and trust in corporations and the military to solve it for us, then we have to look at the solutions that will come from ourselves. And what we find in each of these areas is that not only are the solutions, what's interesting is not only the solution, the real solution really will start to protect those who most need protection, they also are the kind of solutions that will result that can tackle and the underlying causes of climate change in the first place. If you look at the systems of food, for example, the kind of big corporate control of food systems, which encourages a very globalized model, is also actually a very unresilient system to climate change impacts. What you find is that what they found is that after major storms, for example, extreme weather, more diverse local food systems are much more quickly able to recuperate than the big monocrop plantations run by the likes of Monsanto and Syngenta and so on. But actually, the solution both tackle the, and they're also far less polluted, so they cause far less emissions. So really, the solutions that come from a more diverse, localized, local-controlled, community-powered solutions are ones that can both stop worsening climate change and deal with its impacts. You see it similarly in energy. In Puerto Rico right now, those who've recovered most quickly are those who have local solar panels, and they have small microgrids. They're the ones who managed to bring their power much more quickly than others. So, and of course, solar power is a much more green technology. So those are the choices I feel that we need to make right now. We need to build up and support those local solutions that are taking place all around the world, and really build that up from at city and community level, and stop putting our faith in corporations and the military to resolve this crisis.
Nick Buxton, we've got about 5 minutes left. What about environmental organizations? In your book, you document the Nature Conservancy partnering with the military, the National Resources Defense Council partnering with the military, Conservation International helping weapons dealers greenwash themselves, etc. And I could give other examples from my own experience. How do we organize for action on a large scale if these big nonprofit organizations are so deeply compromised?
Well, I think you had this. It wasn't just the military at the same time as that they were kind of bringing the military on board. I think they were also doing the same with corporations. I think there was a whole level of essentially defeatism of some of these activist groups in the 90s that decided power lay with corporations and the military. So if you had them as allies, that would resolve the climate crisis. And we've seen where that's led to. It's led to them greenwashing their practices, going back to our earlier conversation. So Lockheed Martin is very happy to be on the board, and similarly the Defense Department to be a partner in conservation with the Nature Conservancy. They're very happy to have those green organizations giving them a green glow, but they continue to be the primary responsible causes of climate change. So there was a real defeatist attitude. I think that is changing now, though. I think we do have to. I think there is a growing recognition, especially since economic crisis in 2008, 2009, and also really that's kind of been brought to the fore by the election of Trump, that has made people realize that we can't either stay in these silos where we just talk to ourselves, nor can we ignore the need to kind of make connections between movements. And we can't ignore the need to kind of go much deeper and more and look at the kind of systemic causes of these crises, that the causes of climate crisis and the causes of huge inequality in the world are the same ones. They're about money concentrated in very few hands and protected by a vast and disproportionate spending on military. And so I'm quite hopeful, actually, that I think these things are starting to break down. I see it a lot I live in California, but I see it similarly in my home country of the UK, that a lot of organizations are starting to make those connections and starting to look much more systemically. So I'm hopeful. And I think a lot of that's been built up at local level, in local campaigns, in local coalitions, in local cities. So you have cities like in Barcelona in Spain, which is both tackling housing, but also saying we can't have a just solution for housing if we don't also look at those, if we don't also have international solidarity and recognize their interconnections and their sort. So they're also making really strong statements on international trade. They're also making statements on militarism. They're on immigration. But I think those kind of connections are being made, and they're the ones that we should do. And I think, if I could just finish with this point, I think one of the stories that we draw to attend, we kind of conclude our book with, is the one of Hurricane Sandy, where you had this storm slam into New York, and it cut out the power supplies through to the subways, to the public hospitals, and one building was left alight, and that was Goldman Sachs, because it had its generators, and it was able to build sandbags to protect itself. So you had the whole of Manhattan kind of going black, except for Goldman Sachs. So you very much had that symbol of the private corporation being secure and the public dispossessed. And then you had a very typical response, and they sent in the National Guard. But what was actually put them to shame was the organizing of the communities that came out of the Occupy movement, who at one point had
20 seconds,
thousands of volunteers across the city organized in 12 centers. And they really showed that actually crises, we think it brings out the worst in people, but actually can bring out the best. It can bring out actions of solidarity, of real effective cooperation and communication. And those are the kind of responses that we're going to need to climate change. So that's where really the book finishes. We've got a lot of hope here that we can grab, that the crisis is an opportunity to re-change our systems and to approach the world that we live in a very different and just way.
It's a great note to end on. Wish we could go on. Nick Buxton's book is The Secure and the Dispossessed, How the Military and Corporations Are Seeking to Shape a Climate-Changed World. Nick, thank you for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you, David.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, the millions of leaked documents dubbed the Paradise Papers bring some sunlight to an arena where secrecy is the whole point. The world of offshore financial centers, where a melange of the world's wealthiest stash money, bilk governments, and generally betray any notion of a social compact. It's great reporting. It involves trillions of dollars. Now what? We'll speak with investigative economist and author James Henry. Also on the show, after a man killed 26 people and wounded 20 more in a Texas church, and his demographic details signaled media would be going the troubled individual route, some have lifted up the relationship between mass killings and domestic violence, of which the Texas killer, like many before him, had a history. We talked about those connections after another mass shooting last year in Orlando, Florida, with writer and activist Soraya Chamali. We'll hear some of that conversation today. All of that's coming up, but first we'll take a quick look back at recent press. In September, the Los Angeles Times ran a two-part series on the tax and other benefits the Disney Corporation managed to extract in Anaheim, California, and on their efforts to influence city council elections. In a particularly ham-fisted move, Disney, though they didn't call for any actual corrections, barred LA Times reporters from advance press screenings for its movies in retaliation. Journalists took umbrage. The Washington Post's Alyssa Rosenberg said she would boycott screenings until Disney backed down. The New York Times agreed, issuing a statement saying, "A powerful company punishing a news organization for a story they do not like is a dangerous precedent and not at all in the public interest." The National Society of Film Critics and others disqualified Disney from awards. This week, citing productive discussions with LA Times leadership, Disney rescinded the ban. Journalistic solidarity, claimed The Washington Post's Eric Wemple, served notice to Disney and, quote, all prospective bullies. We media types sometimes do live up to the glorious principles that we mouth at panel discussions, close quote. It was indeed commendable action. So, maybe now they've got this solidarity thing going with the glorious principles and the concern about the powerful punishing people for stories they don't like, corporate media could stretch the idea enough to see where solidarity is needed on issues perhaps even more pressing than whether you got your Thor Ragnarok review before opening night or a day after. Ramsey Orta filmed New York police choking his friend Eric Garner to death on a Staten Island sidewalk in 2014. Since then, Orta and others believe he has been targeted by police, raiding his home and arresting him on questionable drug charges, and then for obstructing governmental administration when he filmed another arrest. As activist writer Josmar Trujillo reminds at fair.org, after Orta took a plea in 2015, an unnamed NYPD source told the New York Daily News, "He took the video," alluding to the Garner tape, "now we took the video," referring to surveillance footage police claim showed Orta selling drugs. Ramsey Orta has no formal training or press credentials. He's from the streets of New York, and he's had constant contact with the criminal justice system. Just the qualities, Trujillo notes, that can make it easier to connect to people on the ground, particularly in communities of color, where there's often suspicion and resentment towards reporters, and the qualities that make citizen journalists like Orta uniquely effective in creating media for those usually left out. The failure of mainstream journalists to support or acknowledge Orta points to the need to challenge some imaginary lines. What the LA Times was doing with its Anaheim story and what Orta was doing with the Garner video are the same activity. Getting information to the public that's meaningful, not least because it's information powerful forces don't want the public to see. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair. A Establishment media cover poverty sometimes, sometimes in a compassionate and compelling way. And they cover wealth and the rich sometimes, sometimes in a thoughtful and critical way. When the discussion called for is about the relationship between the two, the limits of media's spotlight approach are salient. Such a case may be presented by the Paradise Papers, a trove of some 13 million documents leaked to German newspaper Süddeutsche Zeitung and then shared with the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists that describes various tax hiding and avoidance schemes used by politicians and celebrities along with corporations. Stories like the New York Times, Paradise Papers shine light on where the elite keep their money, make it all seem pretty dog bites man. We read cases like that of Twitter investor Yuri Milner, who used money from a Russian state-controlled bank, or the hedge funder who hid money somehow in Bermuda. But without serious interrogation of the impacts, it comes off a bit like profiles of people who are richer than you and also smarter, especially as so much coverage seems to pivot on the fact that these activities are not illegal. So what's the next step on disclosures like these? How do we move them from journalistic feat to drivers of real change? And what sorts of changes do they suggest are necessary? Joining us now to discuss the Paradise Papers is investigative economist James Henry. He's a senior advisor at the Tax Justice Network, senior fellow at Columbia University Center for Sustainable Investment, and a contributor to the 2016 book Global Tax Fairness. Welcome back to Counterspin, James Henry.
Good to be with you.
Well, we can't cover them all naturally, but what are some of the sorts of mechanisms or maneuvers that are revealed in these documents that mainly come from this place, Appleby, a Bermuda law firm that specializes in offshore funding?
The big picture, I think, takeaways from this is that we have a global haven industry that consists of a whole lot of enablers like Appleby and other law firms mentioned in this include U.S. law firms like Baker McKenzie, the big accounting firm KPMG. You know, we've seen this pattern over and over again. But basically, the one story here is that this industry is now expanded to the point where at least $30 trillion of private offshore wealth, maybe $3 trillion of corporate wealth is offshore beyond the reach of tax authorities. So, you know, that's about 12% of total world financial wealth. And if you went back 30 years when I started writing about this in the 80s, they were talking about 15 havens. Now there's more than 90 offshore. The Paradise Papers are kind of the latest installment. A lot of the journalists writing on this are, you know, under the age of 35 and are writing about it for the first time. But I'm just impressed with how long we've known about it and how little we have done effectively to clean it up.
Well, and when you start to talk about the amounts involved, it kind of moves us directly on to the impact. I mean, one can imagine, of course, that this is what could be the impact of that amount of money if it actually had, was actually taxed and actually could contribute to the public coffers in the way it was intended.
We have a big problem, not so much with tax dodging, but with kleptocracy. This mm-hmm. is a problem of public officials helping themselves to the public wealth and moving it offshore to these havens, financial secrecy jurisdictions, where they can hide it beyond the reach of the home country. So we saw in this Paradise Papers, I worked on a project involving Angola, where the son of the dictator was basically using the sovereign wealth fund as a kind of ATM, $5 billion moving offshore to havens like Mauritius, which is an African tax haven, you know, with the help of U.S. banks and KPMG and Swiss tax advisors. So you have to imagine the global haven industry as not just about tax havens. I mean, there's a kind of a Star Wars bar scene of clients here. You have the kleptocrats. You have the giant multinationals like Apple, Nike, both of them were mentioned in the Paradise Papers here as moving assets offshore beyond the reach of tax authorities, paying themselves royalties tax-free. You know, then you have mobsters, and then you have the royals. We saw the Queen and Prince Charles mentioned in these papers. Bono, the rock star who likes to worry about development issues, in this case, turns out he's been pretty aggressive use of tax havens to shelter his own income. So, you know, there's all kinds of people who have their snouts in the trough here. And the basic thing they're sharing is this access to financial secrecy, which, you know, without these leaks, we wouldn't know all this stuff. And, you know, I think that that's the problem that the world really fails to address, because this industry is probably one of the most influential on the planet in terms of lobbying, political contributions. So it's not so much that we lack the technical ideas to clean up the industry, but we have lacked the political will. I think one thing that comes out of this that I think is really important is to it sort of lays the foundations for a different system of taxation to get at this stuff. And I have proposed, Jeffrey Sachs has proposed, a global wealth tax, which really goes at the top class in the world, and 1-2% per year tax on wealth, especially anonymous wealth. Most of the stuff, we don't know where it is. If you just withheld against it, you don't really have to know who owns it.
Right.
But we're facing a situation where, in order to, say, realize the development goals that we've established, the world's poorest economies by the year 2030, we need about $80 billion a year. And this kind of revelation just justifies the imposition of a cross-country wealth tax on billionaires and high net worth individuals with assets more than $30 million. And, you know, you could easily raise the money that we need.
Well, and let me just say, that is leapfrogging the response that you're talking about. It leapfrogs this whole question of legality, which it seems like a lot of reporters are getting almost hung up on. You know, it, first of all, secrecy begs the question of legality. You don't know what's going on. You know, you can't even talk about what's following the law. And then you have made the point that, you know, places are invested in this business model. And so, you know, the sanctions may not exist, but that's also part of the problem.
The legality defense of this activity is really the standard defense you hear from the havens every time this comes up. And it's such a red herring. I mean, the point is, first of all, in a lot of countries like, let's say, Angola, these activities aren't illegal because they control the show. Secondly, in the first world countries like the United States and the UK and Switzerland, where a lot of this money ends up ultimately, they have devised very complicated legal structures. And so the question of what is legal is really a whole process involving lots of interpretations and laws. Even if you knew what these people were up to, it would be hard to pronounce. The way it works in an accounting firm like KPMG is they say, you know, what's legal? We define it as tax structure that has a 50% chance of surviving an audit. So it comes down to a kind of probability distribution. There is no bright line between legal and illegal, but that's just a standard kind of response. The real point is this stuff should be illegal. You know, whether it is or not is, you know, a question for thousands of lawyers.
Well, let me just take you back to the big picture for a moment, because I find myself, you know, my frustration in reading some of the coverage comes from the other media that I know exists out there, you know, the media climate, which propagates this view that basically poor people take from the state, you know, and rich people don't rely on the state, and therefore owe nothing to it. You know, I mean, there's an ideological kind of problem here that these bombshells don't seem to break through.
Well, that's right. I mean, the problem really is a political one where we have to educate people about what's going on. I mean, you know, many of the largest fortunes on the planet derive from state activity or have benefited from it in many, many ways. These people have enormous amounts of, I guess, representation without taxation. So they really want to control the political system and influence it directly on a host of policy issues that are favorable to them. But on the tax side, they really want us to go back to the Middle Ages, when we had peasants pay all the taxes and the landlords and the feudal lords paying nothing. I don't think that's a recipe for a healthy democracy. And the United States was at the forefront of designing and defending a progressive tax system. And the current trends are in the opposite. We're going to end up with middle class and the poor paying all the taxes, and the wealthy just taking advantage of globalization to offshore their wealth.
Well, it seems a good point to mention. I had left it out, but the same CNBC analyst who had told us that Trump's tax plan is the farthest thing possible from a plan for the 1%, he had this to offer, and I'll just leave you with this. What's the biggest takeaway from the Paradise Papers leak? America needs tax cuts. Now, you know.
Well, that's ridiculous. That's absolutely false. Historically, we've had 30, 40 years of tax cuts. The corporate tax has been chopped again and again. We've been also on the individual side. We've been engaged in a race to the bottom with other countries around the planet. No major U.S. multinational pays anything like 35% corporate tax rate. You know, Apple's average tax rate is less than 5% because they take advantage of the offshoring that they're already able to do. And, you know, the average effective rate for corporations, including small business in the country, is about 12% right now after all the tax breaks. Furthermore, these companies are the most powerful and most successful in the world. They're at an all-time high in terms of stock market valuation and corporate profits as a share of national income. So it's just ludicrous to propose that the United States somehow is suffering. What we would suffer from would be a gigantic inflated deficit if this tax bill were passed on the order of $2 trillion, which we, you know, I thought the Republicans were opposed to that. But it would be an immediate $800 billion gift to the top 100 companies on the planet that have stashed $2.6 trillion offshore because, you know, the first stage of it would give them a 5 to 10% tax rate on any of that they rebated without conditions. And so that would be a huge payday for them.
We've been speaking with James Henry. He's a senior fellow at Columbia University Center for Sustainable Investment, a global justice fellow at Yale University, and senior advisor at the Tax Justice Network. James Henry, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
You're very welcome.
After the Sutherland Springs, Texas mass shooting, media picked up the familiar threads on gun violence and mental health, but some also took up the less commonly explored, though established, connections between mass shootings and domestic violence. And not just whether those with records of domestic violence, as the Texas shooter had, should be able to buy guns, but the bigger problem of how domestic violence is portrayed, you might say dismissed, including by media, as a private problem rather than a societal one. We talked about this last June after the mass murder at the Pulse nightclub in Orlando, Florida. Writer and activist Soraya Chamali directs the Women's Media Center Speech Project and is organizer of the Safety and Free Speech Coalition. She had just written about domestic violence and the Orlando shooting for Rolling Stone.
Well, I'll start where your article starts. I was not, in fact, surprised to learn that the killer in Orlando had a record of domestic violence. Why wasn't I?
Well, I think time and time again, we've seen examples, and we could go through a list, Sandy Hook, the Sydney shootings. I'd forgotten about that, but that had started in domestic violence, the Colorado abortion clinic attack. And so when you see it happen, and it's such a distinct pattern in the course of the violence, you sort of wait for the other shoe to drop. And I think what happens is that most people who maybe aren't attuned to this particular dimension will see items in the news that are fairly poorly framed or given headlines that don't really address perpetration, but instead identify victims. It's hard to then understand the wider context for this idea that it's violence in homes and tolerance, societal tolerance for violence in homes, that is the necessary precursor to all of this public violence.
Well, connecting dots between coercive and abusive behavior, some of which is considered normal, you know, and lethal violence doesn't mean saying every domestic abuser is a mass murderer in the making, but it's a value in seeing these echoes, right, in terms of telling us all of the points that we need to engage.
That's right. I mean, I think a lot of people hear 57%, I think it's 57% of mass killings start in acts of intimate partner violence or, you know, family violence, whether it's sons killing parents and siblings, or fathers killing entire families, or ex-spouses attacking intimates. They leap from that to hearing instead all domestic abusers are going to be mass killers, which is obviously just kind of a breakdown in logic. But I think that as a society, we're trying to figure out, why is this happening? How can we prevent it from happening? And very clearly, one thing we have to do, otherwise I really do believe efforts will fail, even though clearly, you know, better gun control would reduce the number of gun deaths we have. But clearly, one of the things we have to do is really take a step back introspectively and look at how tolerant we are of violence in homes. Very hands-off about it still.
Right. And of course, you don't want to be framing it as, let's pay attention to men who commit domestic violence because they might go on to do, you know, something else.
That's
the
right.
point is what they're doing now. Well, some people, not enough maybe, but some noted that a week before the killings, conservative Christian leader James Dobson had suggested that men take up arms to defend their wives from trans people in bathrooms. He said, if you are a married man with any gumption, surely you will defend your wife's privacy and security. If this had happened 100 years ago, someone might have been shot. Where is today's manhood? Well, there's a line between that and killing queer people in a club, and it doesn't pass through Islam, you know.
Right.
At the same time, Dobson said, Barack Obama is a tyrant. He is determined to change the way males and females relate to one another. And I think that gets at something that you wrote about as well.
What we're looking at here is this clash of some very, very fundamental beliefs about gender roles and gender identity. And there simply are people who, for whatever reasons, psychological, emotional, financial, they really believe in binary gender roles, rigid gender roles, and changes in the culture that destabilize that belief are highly threatening. So that's why public bathrooms are such a flashpoint. I mean, the point is that women and children are much, 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 much more vulnerable in their own homes and in places of worship to sexual assault than anybody is in a public bathroom. I mean, that's just clear factually on the basis of what we know. So the public bathroom flashpoint is more symbolic of the fear that people have about those cultural changes. And in this shooting, you know, we really don't know enough about the man as an individual in terms of sexual shame or sexual practices. But what we do know is that he was extremely abusive to his first wife. He treated her like a piece of property. He held her hostage. He violently assaulted her. And he thought that was his right. And in point of fact, he wasn't really challenged in that ultimately, because while she was removed from the home by her family, the family, for a wide variety of reasons, as families often do, don't want to criminalize the person. And so there ends up being, for lack of a better way of putting it, a kind of hermeneutic void in public understanding, because we are so silent, so shamed by what is happening in homes, that we cannot construct the language or the public policy to make sense of it and to then prevent it.
And with that is an inability to collect data, I heard you say on Democracy Now!, to collect the kind of data that would make it a coherent issue so we could see the scope.
Absolutely.
Right. Well, I remember in 2014, a man came to New York City and killed two police officers, and the media were like, basically, oh, right, and before that, he shot his girlfriend. You know, it was very clearly segregated. It was not of a piece in the story.
No.
You know, it was
like incidental. By the way.
It was like what happened before he was violent, you know. Stopping doing that would be good. Stopping saying that people had no history of violence when they have records of domestic violence. What else would you ask for from media in terms of this issue?
Oh, well, I'd like media to diversify its own management, because as long as we have distinctly not diverse management and ownership of media, we will continue to have these kind of epistemologically skewed understandings of the world. We're not asking the right questions, so we cannot end up with the right headlines or the right counter-narratives. And that connection is, I think, also fairly elusive. I mean, it's hard for media to critique itself, right? I mean, the reason that we don't have a good understanding of domestic violence and sexual violence and the role that those play in persistent misogyny and racism is, frankly, because we don't have a very diverse media. And so people tell stories that tend to reflect their own experiences or that they understand. And as a result of that, we just don't see these stories in dynamic profusion.
Right. And you sometimes wonder why some stories do rise to the surface. The Stanford rapist, for example, you feel grateful for the opportunity to shine a light on certain things. But part of you says, you know, this happens every day, right? You know,
right.
And but for media, it's almost as though the everydayness of a problem means it gets less attention. Yeah.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I actually had just this morning published a piece about why the Stanford story became viral.
Mm-hmm.
What was that? Because it is something that happens absolutely every day. And there are some other really horrific stories that are extremely similar, like the Vanderbilt gang rape case last year, that didn't raise any public alarms. And what I think is interesting about the Stanford case is that it brought together the Title IX movement and the Black Lives Matter movement in a very graphic way. I mean, Brock Turner's face really became a graphic symbol of those two issues coming together in their mutual critique of fraternal white male supremacy. And it just happened to be at this moment of time that those two forms of entitlement, which are often exercised in rape, came together.
That was writer-activist Saraya Chamali speaking with Counterspin in June of 2016. In a new Village Voice piece in the wake of the Texas shooting, Chamali cites a landmark four-decade study of 70 countries that found that the most important force in reducing violence against women, more significant than economic wealth or even government representation, was a social commitment to strong, independent feminist movements. And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them on our website, fair.org. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
We have a very packed show for you this week. I'll be talking with French Senator Ronan Dantec about the Bonn climate talks. We will explore what the very first trees can tell us about climate change. But first, an alarming study shows 77% of insects in German nature areas have disappeared over the last 30 years. I'm Alex Smith, and this is Radio EcoShock. We like butterflies because they're pretty and they don't bite. The rest of the insects eat our crops, give us diseases, they bite us, they fly in our faces and our windshields. If we took a poll, maybe most humans would like to have an insect-free world, but be careful what you wish for. A new study shows insect numbers in parts of Europe have crashed just since 1990. The paper is titled More Than 75% Decline Over 27 Years in Total Flying Insect Biomass in Protected Areas. It was published in the journal PLOS on October 18, 2017. Our guest is Dr. David Goulson. He is a professor of biology at the University of Sussex in the UK. He is a co-author of the new study, and it's generated some alarm and some worrying headlines. From the deep south of England, Dave Goulson, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Pleasure to be here.
Well, people love cats and whales, but it's hard to find insect lovers. Why shouldn't we cheer if there are a lot less of them?
Well, actually, there are some insect lovers around, including me, but whether you love them or hate them, people should appreciate them. because insects are actually really important. They make up about two-thirds of all life on Earth, for a start. They do some really vitally important things, like pollinating our crops. About three-quarters of the crops that people grow around the world need pollinating. So if we didn't have flying insects, we wouldn't have tomatoes or strawberries or blueberries or any number of other things we like to eat. They do other all sorts of other important things ecologically. They recycle dung, which may not sound very glamorous. It isn't, but it's important. They help to control pests of crops, and they're food for so many things. So we might not be very keen, or not everybody's keen on insects, but most people appreciate seeing pretty birds in their garden. But most birds feed on insects, as do bats, small mammals, reptiles, amphibians, and so on. So basically, if you were to take away the flying insects, pretty much the rest of life on Earth would collapse.
Well, let's get to the science you've just taken part in. The news reports certain types of insects are declining, sure, but why did you undertake this new study?
So I should say, for the sake of accuracy, that I helped write it up, but I didn't collect the data. It was actually collected by insect enthusiasts, amateur entomologists in Germany over the last 30 years. They've been running insect traps, they're called malaise traps. They just catch any flying insect that buzzes by. I'm not entirely sure why they started, probably just from their own amateur interest. But they produce this really interesting and disturbing data set, which basically shows that their daily catch, the weight of insects they caught every day, has plummeted. So over a 27-year period, it's fallen by 75%, three-quarters.
And these were not just in fields. These were in nature protection areas, I understand.
Yeah, they sampled 62 sites all across Germany, all of them nature reserves, mostly quite small nature reserves. But that almost makes it more terrifying that, these are supposed to be places where nature was being looked after. And so far as we know, it was. The nature reserves are still there. They're still being, managed for nature. And yet, despite that, three-quarters of the insects have disappeared somewhere.
Well, why? I mean, that's the big question we're all going to ask. And I guess, why don't we start with this? I thought that if bugs were in nature protection areas, they will do just fine, but apparently not.
Yeah, well, it is a slight mystery, but we can make an educated guess as to what's going on. We know generally, so there have been other studies of, we have pretty good data for how butterfly populations are doing in most European countries and to some extent in North America, and we know they've been declining. We know moths have been declining. There's been lots of anecdotal suggestion that flying insects on windshields, the splats that you see are less common. And broadly, all of these declines have been put down to essentially the way the landscape has changed, particularly the way farming has intensified. We've lost lots of habitat. We use a lot more pesticides than we used to. There are very few weeds and hence very few flowers to be found in farmland. But of course, these insects were being sampled on nature reserves, not on farmland. So why am I making the link? Basically, because these are flying insects, they buzz about. There's nobody to tell them, stay on the nature reserve, you'll be safe there. So we guess that they buzz off out of the nature reserve, and most of these nature reserves are surrounded by farmland, and that's pretty hostile terrain for an insect, so probably most of them just don't come back.
Well, right. You mentioned this is about flying insects, and I wonder if that's a limitation to this study. I mean, can we say that most insects fly, or do the majority of insects not fly?
The large majority of insects do fly, so the study incorporates most of them. There are some that can't fly or rarely fly, let's say an earwig. Earwigs actually could fly, but they never do for some reason. And I would hazard a guess that if I'm right about the idea that flying insects are more likely to buzz out of the nature reserve, then obviously things that don't fly are more likely to stay put and more likely to be safe. So I would guess that perhaps declines, if there have been any, might be less in non-flying insects. But we simply don't have any data for them, so I am just guessing.
And I was going to volunteer, well, ants don't fly, but they do.
Well, of course, yeah, the workers don't, but the really important ones, the queens and the males, every year do fly around, and they're the ones that start the new nests. So if they get lost, then that's going to have a big impact on the old ants.
Well, Professor Goulson, here on Radio EcoShock, we interview a lot of scientists about climate change, and maybe we assign too much to that as a single cause. I know your team looked into this. Did climate change help kill off these insects in Europe?
I think we can say pretty certainly that the answer to that is no. So we built kind of mathematical models to try and explain what was happening with the insects, and we got weather data, which we built into the models. And insect numbers do vary a lot according to the weather. Some years are better than others. They tend to like sunny, warmer years and are more common. But the overall decline, this 75% loss over 27 years, is not explained at all by changing weather patterns. And in fact, in reality, climate overall has changed very little. If you take a single 27-year period, there's almost negligible change in average temperature. And what change there is doesn't explain anything of what's going on.
It's strange because I remember being told that insect generations could reproduce more quickly in a hotter world, and yet this seems to be going in the opposite direction.
It's certainly true that warming climate will be an advantage to some insects, particularly pest insects, which are the ones that are kind of most adaptable. They're very mobile. They breed very fast. And most insects are ectotherms. They basically thrive in warm weather. Of course, that's sort of oversimplifying rather a lot, because climate change isn't necessarily about it getting warmer so much as it getting more variable. And some of the extreme weather events that are being predicted under climate change will probably not be good for insects. So, you know, very heavy rain and storms and droughts and so on will be harmful. But if it were all just a gentle increase in temperature, then there certainly would be some insects that would enjoy that very much.
Homes and landscaping are designed to keep the bugs out. Is it possible that paving over Europe is one factor behind the insect decline that your team measured?
It certainly isn't helping. Yeah, absolutely. I do a lot to try and encourage people to plant their gardens with flowers to feed the butterflies and the bees and so on. And there's a lot of people interested in doing that, both over here and in North America. But there are also many, many people who would prefer to have their entire garden tarmacked or covered in decking. And of course, that doesn't help. It adds to this overall picture of there's just been less and less habitat left, less and less flower-rich, semi-natural places for them to go and find food or build a nest or whatever. I don't think probably paving over of gardens is a major player, but it's probably contributing.
My wife has me putting out a plate with some stones in it with some water so the bees have a way to get a drink as they work around through our garden.
Yeah, that does work. It's only really honeybees that you regularly see drinking, which are more or less a domestic animal. But it's certainly a very simple, easy thing to do. But better still, if you were to plant, a lavender bush, then you'd be providing lovely nectar for bees, and you'd probably see a lot more come.
Well, now, the other obvious culprit would be the vast amounts of pesticides sprayed by farmers these days. What do you think?
I would agree that pesticides are certainly contributing here, probably make one of the bigger players, one of the more likely culprits, if you like. It's certainly true that we use a lot of pesticides in the modern world. For the last 60, 70 years, farming has become very heavily reliant on a whole barrage of insecticides and other chemicals, fungicides and herbicides and so on. The herbicides enable farmers to grow crops without any weeds, hence without any flowers. And the insecticides, well, they're designed to kill insects, and some of them are very, very toxic to all insect life. Some of them are quite persistent, so they contaminate soils and streams and turn up in wildflower pollen, nectar, and so on.
In recent years, you've been co-author on a number of papers on the impacts of pesticides on bees. Has the mystery of bee colony collapse been solved?
I'm not sure it will ever be definitively solved. People will argue forever, but I think most people accept that the bee health problems we've seen are the result of several stressors all at the same time on the bees, that basically they struggle to find much food in the modern world. There aren't many flowers. They tend to have a very monotonous diet because they tend to often be forced to forage on one, whatever crop happens to be in flower. they are then exposed to lots of pesticides. And we've also made life pretty tough by accidentally spreading bee diseases around the world, diseases and parasites. So if you add those things together, if the bee is hungry and infected with a foreign disease and poisoned all at the same time, then it's probably little wonder that they sometimes die.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is Dr. Dave Goulson from the University of Sussex. My initial protective rationalization of the serious result in your paper was, oh, that's just Germany. There's lots of bugs left here in Canada. Do we know if this decline in Europe reflects insects in trouble in other parts of the world?
That is a really good question. And obviously, the study was in Germany. It's always dangerous to extrapolate. And we clearly don't know exactly what someone would have found if they'd done exactly the same thing in Canada or the US or the UK. All we can say really is that where we do have data for butterflies, for moths, for birds, generally for wildlife, we know our wildlife is in decline on a global scale. The exact rate of the decline, is obviously varies from country to country and place to place. But Germany's pretty typical, I would say. Certainly, knowing Germany fairly well, the landscape is very similar to the UK and much of Western Europe. The crops they grow are very similar. The pesticides they use are very similar. So my guess is if it's happening in Germany, then something similar is happening in other European countries. Extrapolating to Canada is a bit more tenuous. Who knows? But we do know that things aren't going well. And if this German decline is anywhere near typical of what's happening elsewhere in the world, then we haven't got much time to fix this. We can't spend another 20 or 30 years doing some more studies to find out whether the same patterns are happening elsewhere, because 20 or 30 years' time on current trajectory, there'll be virtually nothing left.
Right. Is it possible we could enter a mass extinction of insects and not even realize it?
Well, I think we already have, and it's not that we don't realize it, but most people aren't that interested in insects. It's obviously very difficult to say when something goes extinct definitively because, proving the absence of a species is hard. And when it's an insect that most people don't pay any attention to, it's doubly hard. We've seen, for example, the first global extinction of a bumblebee in California, actually. This is Franklin's bumblebee. Hasn't been seen now since 2006 and is presumed extinct. And there are many more bees that have declined very dramatically and are in imminent danger of extinction. Obviously, we know a little more about bees than we do about other species. Butterflies are also in trouble. We've seen various extinction events. And so far as we can tell, it's accelerating. So we are going to lose more and more species unless we really find a way to tackle these issues.
Well, let's fast forward another 25 years. We discover we only have half the insects. How could that change the ecosystem and our economy?
Well, I mentioned bees earlier, and that's one of the simplest examples to kind of get your head around. Pollination is enormously important to humans. We simply couldn't feed everyone on the planet without the work that insect pollinators like bees do. So if we were to lose half of them, then there certainly wouldn't be enough to pollinate all of our crops. And it's not that all the crops would suddenly fail. The bees aren't going to all of them disappear overnight. But as their numbers fall, it will mean that the yields of crops fall, which will push the price up of food. It'll make it harder to produce, obviously. It'll mean food becomes scarcer in markets. And probably in, relatively affluent Western countries, we'll still be able to afford to eat. But people in poorer countries may well not. And that's where the crisis would first be felt. But in the long term, we've got a growing human population. We're going to have perhaps 10 billion of us by maybe even more by 2050. And we simply won't be able to feed all of those people unless we look after insect pollinators.
Do you have ideas on what we could do to raise public support for protecting insects, or can we protect them?
Well, there is a growing interest in looking after insects. And more broadly, people have latched onto bees because I think bees make a great kind of flagship group for highlighting that actually, some of these little creatures, they may be underappreciated, but they are important, and we do need to look after them. And I think a growing proportion of the population kind of get that, but there are many, many people that don't think about the environment at all. And I think we need to somehow, I need to somehow, people who care about these issues and care about the future of our planet, they would agree that we somehow need to engage with more people. We need to get politicians on board. We need to get people to change their shopping habits. If people were to buy differently, there are lots of small changes that people can make to their lifestyles that would really help. So just to give you some simple examples, you know, the most of the pressure on wildlife comes about from farming. Well, if we didn't eat so much red meat, everybody knows this, but not many people actually act on it. If we didn't eat so much red meat, then that would greatly reduce the pressure on the land, because producing beef is a hugely inefficient way of feeding people. And also, if we reduced food waste, we are spectacularly wasteful. You know, we do all this intensive farming and then throw away about a third of all the food that we've produced, which doesn't make any sense at all. So, you know, we basically need to try and reduce our footprint, the impact we're having on the planet. And it can be done, but it would take, you know, action at all levels by everybody. And that's pretty difficult to achieve.
We may have to rewire our brains a little bit, too. We have insects in horror movies. We always talk about being at war with the bugs. If we see one, we want to stamp it out, even though we don't know what it is, whether it's friendly or not. We're going to have to change something about the human brain, almost.
Yeah, I'd love it if people just had a little more respect for the natural world. How we get that, I don't know. But it does worry me that people are increasingly detached from nature. They don't realize that, you know, at the end of the day, we are just one species on this planet. And we're lucky enough to share the planet with maybe 10 million other species. We don't know yet. We're still naming them. We've got a long way to go. And aside from all the useful things they do, many of them are stunningly beautiful if you look at them closely, or have really weird and wonderful and fascinating lives and behaviors and so on. Once you start looking, they're absolutely fascinating. But most people just don't look and don't appreciate that they're part of the natural world, like it or not, that we actually need all of these little creatures. How we get people to re-engage with nature, I do not know. But that's one of the many reasons that I write books and appear on radio shows, is to try and get that message across.
Well, tell us about a couple of your books.
Written mostly about the world of insects, bees in particular. Bumblebees are my absolute favorite. I've been studying bumblebees for about 25 years. So I wrote a book called A Sting in the Tail about the weird and wonderful lives of bumblebees. And most recently, I've got a new book out called Bee Quest, which is about exotic travels in search of the world's most weird and wonderful bees, which may sound terribly obscure, but people who've read it seem to enjoy it. It is basically my ploy to try and snag people's interest and draw them in and persuade them that actually that these creatures are really cool and we should appreciate what they do.
From the University of Sussex, we've been speaking with Professor Dave Goulson. He's the co-author of a new paper, More Than 75% Decline Over 27 Years in Total Flying Insect Biomass in Protected Areas. And you can find links to all this in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Dave, thank you so much for volunteering your time with us.
It's been a pleasure.
Imagine a world without trees, and then their first arrival. A team of scientists have painstakingly analyzed the remnants of ancient trees. Nature's first attempt to build tall living towers, all from carbon, was difficult, and it was strange. Trust me, trees changed Earth more than you know. Answers have been published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. The title is Unique Growth Strategy in the Earth's First Trees, Revealed in Silicified Fossil Tree Trunks from China. The lead author is Honghei Xu from the Chinese Academy of Sciences in Nanjing. Our guide in this program is co-author Dr. Christopher Berry. He's a senior lecturer in paleobotany at Cardiff University in the UK. From Wales, Chris Berry, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much.
Touring around in your past publications, you seem to me to be a detailed man and certainly a tree detective. When did you set out on that trail and why?
I can't really explain it. I got interested in paleontology when I was a kid. My father took me out collecting fossils. So I had an inbuilt interest in fossils, particularly finding shelly fossils and animals. And then I studied mainly maths, physics, and chemistry at school. And I went off to university. I went to Cambridge University to do physics, and I hated every minute of it. So I looked around for something else to do. And I decided I would also take a course in geology. I listened to some lectures by Simon Conway Morris on paleontology and met a few interesting people, including Harry Whittington, the great Burgess Shale fossil man, and I became a paleontologist.
So before we get to your latest science, which has landed in major newspapers, I'd have to say, I'd like to step back to a previous stunning article where you were a co-author. I'm talking about the 2015 paper whose title starts out, Investigating Devonian Trees as Geoengineers of Past Climates. Could you unpack that for us, starting with the Devonian, and then how early trees could massively change the climate on Earth? But take as long as you need to do that, Chris.
Well, I didn't write that paper. The person who wrote the paper, Jenny Morris, is in the office just across the corridor from me. But I was very much involved in setting up that project. What we're trying to do is not just look at trees as fossils, but trees as organisms impacting with the environment. And so what we looked for were sites that we could go to and investigate fossil soils, which had evidence of trees growing in them. And we'd start working on geochemistry of the soils, just look at the soils, see what the impact of the plants were on the soils. In particular, there was a very interesting place in upstate New York, quite near the famous Gilboa Fossil Forest, where we could see massive rooting systems, which were formed by some of the earliest woody trees that came just after the sort of things that we'll probably be talking about, as well as some of these cladozoolopsid trees as well. This enabled us to literally drill down into the soils, the fossil soils beside these trees, and see where the roots are going, see what they were up to, and to look at the geochemistry of what was going on. The paper that you just mentioned is a preliminary paper, so we haven't published yet the results for that, but I think they're going to be quite interesting and quite detailed in terms of geochemistry and so on. The reason for being interested in soils and plants is because plants not only absorb carbon directly, I think most people would realize that plants are formed out of carbon, and if you squash them on geological timescales, they turn into coal. But plants also absorb carbon from the atmosphere by an indirect route, whereby the action of roots, root hairs, and fungi associated with the roots and the whole root ecosystem takes carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and reacts it with the silicate minerals and water and produces carbonic acids. And that carbonic acid is in solution now. The carbon is effectively in solution in the ions, and this can be washed through the groundwater into rivers and washed downstream into the sea. And there the carbon finds itself being used by shelly animals, micro animals or shelly animals like clams and so on. And it becomes calcium carbonate in the shells of these animals. And thereby it can be incorporated into limestones and be locked into the rock record. So that carbon started off as carbon dioxide in the atmosphere has by this long tortuous route involving plant roots being taken down and locked into the seafloor, and therefore carbon dioxide is pulled out of the atmosphere. So that's really the system that we're trying to investigate there. It's obviously quite well known in the modern day, and we were in this work trying to take it back and really examine the impact of Devonian trees on soils and soil geochemistry.
And your work has hovered around the time trees began, and my mind has a little trouble imagining Earth without trees, but apparently they are relative newcomers. It must have been kind of a flat landscape without trees. What was there before them?
Well, there were smaller and smaller plants as you go back into the early parts of the Devonian and into the Silurian before that. And there's some debate about whether there were land plants during the Ordovician and even the Cambrian, going back nearly 500 million years. There's fragmentary evidence that suggests that there were perhaps things on land producing spores quite early on, but those would have been very, very small plants indeed, less than an inch or two high probably. But most likely there were green layers of slimy algae, bacterial mats and things like that for quite a while before land plants got invented. There were some very strange sort of giant fungi, some of which have really quite enormous trunk-like fossils found in the early parts of the Devonian, which may have been the first things that vaguely look like trees, but they're really the stalks of giant mushrooms or something like that. They weren't land plants in the sense that we know them today.
It's an almost magic world that you're talking about. Now, what is the basic engineering challenge nature faced as trees struggle to evolve?
Well, there's a variety of different things. First of all, to get land plants to grow at all, they need to have a coating on the outside, a cuticle, which means that they can control gas exchange. They need to have little pores called stomata to literally control on a moment-to-moment basis gas exchange and to stop water loss. They need roots, but most of all, they really need structural tissues, particular types of cells which give the plants strength to stand up, and they're reinforced with a biopolymer called lignin, and so they have quite thick walls, and as well as conducting water, they will help support the plant. So it's growing cells like that that's important. Even little plants can usually grow these types of cells. What you need to do to be a tree is to learn to grow them in a sort of continuous manner and continue to produce them so that you can enlarge the trunk so the crown of the tree can grow upwards into the sky. We're used to seeing that in normal trees. When you cut a tree down, you see a set of concentric rings, usually, depending on your climate, but usually there's a set of concentric rings called tree rings. We're used to seeing that. And that shows the addition year by year of extra xylem cells in rows around the outside of the tree. And those xylem cells are produced by a layer of dividing cells called the cambium. And that occurs just underneath the bark of the tree.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, Dr. Chris Berry from Cardiff University. This is Radio EcoShock. And moving to your new paper published this October in PNAS, you've said the earliest trees used kind of a crazy, I think that was the word used, kind of construction method to do this. What were they like?
Well, it's very complicated and it's quite hard to explain in words over the radio, but I'll give you a shot at it. Just underneath the outer surface of the trunk, which in the lower part was covered in little rootlets going downwards towards the soil, just underneath that layer, there were up to a couple of hundred small rods of this xylem material, which are individual rods in a ring. And each of these rods is about the size of a pencil, and each one of those had its own cambium around the outside, and so it was producing tree rings on an individual basis. So when you look at the section of the trunk, you just see a big ring of these little strands with its own growth ring. So it looks like 200 tiny little trees all growing in unison. But that's a simple part of the plant. Just inside that, forming a layer about 5 centimeters thick on a trunk, which may be in itself 50, 60, or 70 centimeters in diameter. Forming a layer about 5 centimeters thick, there's a series of interconnected xylem strands, which are a little bit smaller, but they form a sort of structural lattice or truss-like network connecting the outer straight strands together and interconnected one to another to form this amazing sort of diamond pattern. So you can imagine something a bit like inside the tree, if you could see through it with X-ray specs, you'd see a structure that was a bit like a round version of the Eiffel Tower with a hollow center and then this amazing network of xylem strands around the outside and then straight xylem strands on the very exterior of the trunk part of the plant. So it was a plant that was extremely well engineered to be light, hollow, tall, strong, but made out of wood that was just so interconnected together, it was very, very hard for us to imagine that it could actually change shape, that it could grow.
And what was new in the remnants that were found in China?
So we're used to seeing this type of fossil, particularly in the Gilboa fossil forest in upstate New York. This is a wonderful deposit that's been known for many, many years. It was worked extensively in the 1920s when a quarry was being built for a dam being made in Gilboa. And in that quarry, you get big trunks or bases of exactly the same sort of tree, the cladozoolopsid trees. However, these are preserved as sandstone casts. So you can imagine the tree standing there 385 million years ago, quite happy. And then the entire forest of the trees has been buried in sand to a depth of about 1 meter. And the trees have subsequently died. The insides have rotted. The very inside was hollow anyway. And then the tree base has been filled up by sand. So in Gilboa, although you have hundreds of fossils of these tree bases, all you see is a big sandstone cast and some very thin remains of this incredibly complicated xylem system. And when you look at it under microscope, when you make sections of it, occasionally you see some cells, but you never see any detail of what's been going on within the plant. The amazing thing about the Xinjiang fossils is that they are preserved in silica. So they've been swamped by what seems to be volcanic sand or ash, and the highly mobile silica from that sand and ash has been incorporated into water. It's dissolved in water, been washed into the plant, and then reprecipitated within the cells so that you can see every single cell of the bottom of the trunk just as fresh as on the day that it died. And that's what's remarkable about these fossils. And that's the really incredible thing. So what we see is that the soft tissues, the little round spherical parenchyma soft cells between the xylem strands have been proliferating. They've been increasing in number. And in increasing in number, they probably produce the pressure to push the xylem strands apart and to increase the diameter of the trunk. That's one really important observation. However, I've described to you this xylem skeleton as being an extremely strong structure tied together by many cross connections. In order to make that bigger, you would have to start to tear it apart. And what we see is that at the interconnections of the various xylem strands, where they've been put under tension by the expansion of the trunk, that the connections have literally started to tear. So you can see them pulled apart, and you can see the fact that the ring of cambium, which is producing new xylem cells around the tearing strands, has remained intact and continue to divide and produce new wood, even though the connection between the two is being ripped apart at the same time. So it's sort of ripped apart and self-healed at the same time.
A tree that rips itself apart to grow?
It rips its internal skeleton apart in order to be able to grow, but at the same time, it heals it. And it's slightly more complicated than that at the base, because the base is tied to the ground, and as the trunk above it expands, the sides of the trunk actually bend outwards and roll out across the ground to produce a large flat base about a meter across. So the bottom 50 centimeters of the trunk growing upwards ends up flattened out onto a big 1 meter diameter trunk base on the ground. So it's just remarkable. I'd never have thought that such a thing was possible, but we've seen all the evidence to support this idea.
In that earlier paper, it said that mineral changes brought in the soil by tree roots ultimately caused, quote, a 90% decline in atmospheric CO2 levels through the Paleozoic. With the warming gas CO2 tumbling like that, did early trees create the conditions for an ice age?
Well, that's a very interesting point, because what you would expect is that if you reduce carbon dioxide in the atmosphere by that amount, which is what some models suggest, and there's a bit of empirical evidence to support that, then you would expect large decreases in global temperatures. And I guess today we're worried about little changes of a few percent here and there and what that might do in terms of global climate. So these trees, if they were really geoengineering the atmosphere, then you'd really expect that. But the answer is a little bit more complicated, in fact. I speak for the results of some modeling done by colleagues in Paris and in France on atmospheres through the Devonian and other factors which influence climate. And I also would mention some wonderful maps by Chris Scottese and Art Bucco, which are found on www.scottese.com, in which they show where climatically sensitive sediments are found on the Earth through geological time. So, for example, they show where you find sand dunes for deserts and you find evaporites, which suggest hot temperatures, and so on. And they've mapped these across the world. And what the Devonian seems to show to us is that not much changes in terms of where climatic boundaries are on the Earth. So you don't get big changes in the climate through most of the Devonian. Now, the modelers in Paris have produced models which suggest that, in fact, plants have the capability to warm up the Earth. So the very presence of these trees, rather than simply bare rock, is enough to absorb more of the solar radiation just because of their presence, their greenness, their physiology, their roughness, everything that's going on with the plants. It absorbs heat from the sun. So at the same time you've got carbon dioxide in the atmosphere dropping, you're also growing more and more trees which absorb more heat. So there's a good case to be made for the fact that much of the Devonian is quite stable in terms of temperature and climate in that sense, but that the atmosphere is changing in composition. At the very end of the Devonian comes the first evidence of a south polar glaciation. So there's a short glaciation then, and then we're into the Carboniferous, where, as you know, there's a lot of limestone formed at the beginning of the Carboniferous, and then the coal forests appear towards the middle of the Carboniferous. Those coal forests were, by definition, creating lots of coal, sucking even more carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. And by the time you get these huge forests and huge coal fields, then we're into a proper glaciation. A lot of my colleagues would use the Carboniferous as a good analogy for today, because what you have is a system where you have large equatorial tropical forests. You have a landmass at the southern South Pole, much like Antarctica, which allows the buildup of bigger ice sheets. And you have carbon dioxide, which approximately is the same level as today. So the Carboniferous is a good analogy for the present-day world as well.
And what you've just said stimulates me to think about the Gaia hypothesis presented by James Lovelock, and it sounds like trees altered the chemistry of the soil and the atmosphere to better suit their needs, maybe hydrology too. Do you think life is an active regulator on this planet?
I've long pondered this, and I don't know the answer to that question. I think it's an incredibly good idea, and it particularly tells us that, you know, we got to be careful with disturbing that sort of natural balance of things. I just maybe tell you something which slightly argues against that, in that my poor cladozoolopsids died out. And they died out about the end of the Devonian, the very beginning of the Carboniferous. And there may be some influence of temperature there. They may not have been very capable of coping with frost. They had large soft apices, which, a bit like palm trees, probably couldn't cope with frost. But they weren't what they were at the end of the Devonian as they were in the middle of the Devonian. And I suspect that my trees, my cladozoolopsids, they didn't have leaves. They had little twiggy-like appendages rather than big, flat, green leaves. And those twiggy bits were probably photosynthesizing. They were absorbing carbon dioxide through stomata. And the carbon dioxide levels were so high in the Devonian that they could do that perfectly efficiently without having proper leaves. And it may be the fact that they, amongst other plants, sucked much of the carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere that made them energetically unable to perform as they did when carbon dioxide levels were higher. So they may have sort of hastened their own demise by changing the conditions of the Earth to an atmosphere which they really couldn't tolerate. So they may have done themselves in, or at least done themselves no favors. That's not to say that other plants didn't then evolve, such as ones with leaves and with big woody stems, and in fact take over from them in a sort of a gradual way. And those plants then became the ones which were regulating the atmosphere and so on. So plants didn't become extinct, but my lovely cladozoolopsids, I'm afraid they...
You know, your description sounds perfect for our current situation as humans, something that changes the atmosphere to a point where it can't survive it. But we'll let that drop for now. But I do have one other impression from your new paper in PNAS, and that is that nature can be a kind of do-it-yourself garage mechanic rather than the godlike designer we often imagine. Would you call these first trees a clumsy attempt?
No. These were beautiful trees. These were some of the finest trees ever. I mean, they were just great-looking things, and they lived for 30 million years. Now, tell me that the human race will survive for 30 million years, and I'll maybe disagree with you. These plants were absolutely adapted to the conditions in which they grew in, that they made the world into, and they were very, very successful. However, they were extremely complex and extremely bizarre, and one of the challenges is to understand the evolutionary history of them before they become very obvious in the fossil record. There must have been some strange things going on with plants to allow this particular form of growth to become the dominant one, because normal trees that we see today just seem so much more of a simple idea. A single cambium around the outside growing a big trunk seems like a really sensible way of being a tree. So I think of these trees as great experimenters, but ultimately very, very successful and very well designed.
Well, just like those primitive trees, science has to deconstruct itself to grow larger. What are your next questions, Dr. Chris Berry?
That's a very good question. I intend to try to find out more about this particular time, and I want to take my research back a little bit in time, because I am interested in what came just before these trees. What were the precursors? What was the world like just before these trees evolved? So hopefully the next item on the agenda is maybe an expedition to the north coast of Spitsbergen to try and pick up fossil plants that are 4 or 5 million years older than the first of the cladozoolopsid trees that I've described to you, and to find out more about the environments and the plants that were alive at that time.
We've been talking with Dr. Chris Berry from the School of Earth and Ocean Sciences at Cardiff University in Wales. He's the co-author of a new paper in PNAS revealing the big role of the big vertical players, the first ones in the plant scene, the ancient trees. You can find links to helpful articles and the abstract in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Chris, thank you so much for sharing your time and your insight. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Alex. Absolute pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
In the first week of November, world governments will meet in Bonn, Germany, to plan our reaction to the climate crisis. Called COP23, it is supposed to flesh out commitments in the Paris Climate Agreement of 2015. The conference is being ignored by North American media. Some citizens have not heard of climate change, a few do not believe it, and far more think the United Nations climate process is literally too little too late. A new emissions gap report from the United Nations Environmental Program agrees. It says even if all the emissions cuts promises made at Paris are kept, which seems unlikely, the world would still warm by 3 degrees C by the end of this century. Scientists have called that level of warming catastrophic. Obviously, we need pressure from every level of society to do much more. Our next guest has helped draw together organizations of youth, environmental groups, trade unions, indigenous people, women, and business to put pressure on the governments in Bonn. Ronan Dantec is the French senator for Loire-Atlantique, just re-elected in September. A member of many boards and positions, he serves as chairman of a French special commission on the effects of global warming. Dantec is a member of the French National Council for Ecological Transition. Ronan Dantec is also the spokesman on climate change negotiations for the international organization United Cities and Local Governments. He is the president of the Climate Chance Association, Climat Chance, an organization of non-state actors calling for concrete action on climate change. Senator Ronan Dantec, a warm welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
I appreciate your time as we approach the COP23 climate talks in Bonn. What is the most important task those governments must do there?
It's difficult to have a precise vision of this COP at this moment, because normally it was a technical COP, because, as you know, we had the deal in Paris, the Paris Agreement. We have a very important moment in 2018. But this year, normally this COP is a COP to prepare this new dialogue. It was the framework. But as with President Trump, America decided to go outside of the deal, of the Paris Agreement, it's now a more political moment. And I think that we'll measure in Bonn, of course, with the president of Fiji, the voluntary, the will of the state to continue the dynamic, of course, with the American situation. It's difficult. It's difficult to have this concrete vision. We don't know, for example, if the American delegation try to block the negotiation or just follow the negotiation as a non-member of the deal. We don't know. We don't know at this moment. But after the COP, the framework of this facilitation dialogue will be one of the most important points. Second point is more the question of loss and damage, which is an important point in the COP today, how we pay, how we support the country who today we have big problems with climate change. It's another point, and we know that for this precise question of loss of damage, we have no consensus between all the national governments.
Yes, we just had countries in the Caribbean wiped out by tropical hurricanes, and now we don't know if there is the mechanism to help them pay to rebuild.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it's very difficult. My own opinion is that it's possible to create, maybe it's not so easy, but it's possible to create mobilization to tackle climate change, to try to stabilize the evolution of the climate. It's more difficult very, very difficult to have this mobilization, to have mobilization of money of developing country, just for adaptation and just for the loss and damage. I'm not sure that in a long term, people will agree to pay for the damage. I think it's impossible. It's possible that we have this mobilization, that people pay, that developing country pay to decrease CO2 emission. This is a real deal. Just pay for loss and damage. We know that it would be very difficult.
The latest emissions gap report from the United Nations Environmental Agency, UNEP, says the process is failing to keep us below 2 degrees of warming. Do you agree?
I'm not sure that the report is so clear. The report is not optimistic, of course. It is a very pessimistic report today. But the report didn't say that it's impossible today to stabilize the planet. The report says now if we continue with this way, we can't reach the targets. It's true that if we have not a strong mobilization and first mobilization of new money to help countries in this transition, we can't reach the target. For me, the report just say if we don't increase our effort, of course, it's impossible to reach the target. But it's not impossible today if in the next few years we have new mobilization, new finance mechanism, a real mobilization. We don't have today this mobilization. It is this point with the crucial point and it is the heart of the debate.
You represent a far broader constituency of groups beyond governments who want concrete climate action. Please tell us about the Agadir Declaration.
The Agadir Declaration today is the most large undersea declaration in the history of the climate negotiation. All the networks of local governments, the world networks, C40, UCG, OIT, signed the declaration. The Climate Action Network with the big networks of NGOs signed to, indigenous people, some networks of companies, some networks of women, young girls, with the Agadir Declaration. After two other declarations with the first climate change in Nantes and another summit in Lyon in 2015, we have, with this declaration, the priorities of non-state actors. And the priorities of non-state actors at the world level today, it's first to be a part of the negotiation, because, of course, the negotiation is a negotiation between national governments. But if non-state actors doesn't do the work in the daily life, we can't decrease CO2 emissions. We must integrate more the role of non-state actors, first point. Another, we have around 10 priorities as access of finance for the cities, for example, for the cities in Africa. We have some proposal for increased actions. It's a consensus between non-state actors who are, for me, and of course for us, the key if we want to stabilize climate.
Activists have long used the slogan, think globally, act locally. So let us return to your own city of Nantes on the Loire River near the Atlantic coast. Why is Nantes known as a green city?
As you know, Nantes was green capital of Europe in 2013 with very important distinctions because we are in Nantes, and I was deputy mayor of the city during 10 years. We have strong ambition as for biodiversity. For example, we are a kind of natural reserve in the center of the city. But our action to decrease CO2 emission is very important. Nantes was the first city in France to reuse the tramway with a strong strategy of public transportation in the 2018. We have a strong strategy to develop a district heating system. A large part of houses today in Nantes are connected in this district heating system. It's a strong, very strong investment. And we try to have a consistency, a coherence between all our public policy because, for example, if you develop public transportation but you have not a good urban planning, of course, you can't reach the targets. We need this coherence. And I think not before other cities in France, in Europe, try to have this consistency in mobilization between all the policy and all the actors of the city.
Yes, here's the problem. I remember in 2009 in Copenhagen, The government actors were inside talking, but outside there were large, large crowds of people from all over the world who were concerned about climate change. These groups, the groups that you represent, really, have been shut out of their government's talks on what affects all of our future now.
It's a question. It's a question. Because it's sure me, I represent local government and cities in the negotiation 10 years ago now. And when I arrived in Copenhagen, it was very difficult for us to be present in the negotiation. We have just a small talks at the end during the night in empty room. It was very difficult. For example, in the Paris Agreement, we have a chapter about the role of non-state actors, the role of local government, for example, the role of private sector. I think today there is a real recognition. But it's true that we have some difficulties in Bonn with this next COP because non-state actor has very limited access to the Bula Zone. The Bula Zone is a zone where there is a real negotiation. There are strong access to the other zone, the Green Zone or Bonn Zone, with some side events, some discussion, but the place of the negotiation is not so open. It's a difficulty. My feeling, and it's a chapter of the Agadir Declaration, is that today there is a better recognition of our capacity to do, to have concrete action for tackle climate change. But now we have this place, but our other place is with a place in the heart of the negotiation to have our own opinion of the negotiation of the strategy of each national government. This place is more limited this year, and it's a problem. We need a balance between our role as actor who do and our role as actor who have capacity to have a good pressure in the global negotiation. And for the second point, it's true that we are worried for Bonn, and our place is very limited.
What will your group, Climat Chance, be doing at COP23 meeting in Bonn?
We have some side events to present the results, the incomes of the Agadir summit. We present an important African initiative with commitments of mayors and region presidents of Africa to act and to mobilize civil society in Africa. And we follow the negotiation. As you know, climate change, for us, the importance of Bonn is to push the proposal and the priorities that we discuss in Agadir and another place, because, of course, we have not just one summit in the year, but other events. For example, we organize two another events just before the summit in December with President Macron to put on the table 10 proposals to mobilize finance. But we will be very well present during the COP in Bonn.
From France, we've been speaking with Senator Ronan Dantec, this time also representing the Climate Chance Association. You can find links to the upcoming climate talks and the latest United Nations Environment Report in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Ronan Dantec, thank you so much for speaking with us on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm sorry with my poor English.
Radio EcoShock.
We're out of time. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening, and please join us again next week for more Radio EcoShock. Thank you.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
And yes, that's Fats Domino, Antoine Dominique, who spoke French, Creole, was from New Orleans. And we're going to be speaking shortly, we believe, with Norman Otis Fishman. And are you there, Otis?
Yes, sir.
By golly, we got you. Well, everybody knows Norman Otis Fishman, but I'll remind you, he is a bluesologist. And by the way, you are from Louisiana. So you're eminently...
Yes, I was born in Bienville Parish in Arcadia, Louisiana, in Bienville Parish. And I guess in Louisiana is the only state in the union that has parishes. Everybody else has counties. So I guess that came from the French.
Yeah, and you're right. And you were able to tell Fats Domino that you're from Louisiana. And you got to meet him.
I met him in 1986, and I was trying to go to the library because I have interviewed him on tape, and I think I wrote a story in contrast. So, the next time we have a discussion, I can I'm gonna go back and check that out. And I'm trying to get some things together so I can do my archives because I really want.
Well, we're going to organize a search party. If you've got Fats Domino, we're going to help you find it. We'll appoint 10 people.
Let me tell you one thing. I was checking a thing where Fats Domino played on "Lordy, Lordy, Lordy, Miss Claudie" by Lloyd Price, and Lloyd Price also have an interview with him. But Lloyd Price was influenced by. I guess when you think about New Orleans, you think about Satchmo, Louis Armstrong, and the second biggest person there is Fats Domino. But Lloyd Price spent 10 years in Africa. Lloyd Price was the one that organized the Thriller in Manila. You know, he lived in the Congo for a second. He lived in Nigeria for like 10 years. But I mean, you know, you're talking about a rich history of people that have, you know, grown internationally.
Well, and also we're talking about the foundation of what people call rock and roll. I have a quote here from the Globe and Mail obituary, which knocked me out. and it's here's how it goes, and this is Elvis Presley talking. A lot of people seem to think I started this business, Mr. Presley told Jet Magazine in 1957. But rock and roll music, let me see, get it right here. But rock and roll was here a long time before I came along. Nobody can sing that music like colored people. Let's face it, I can't sing it the way they can, the way I can. I can't sing it like Fats Domino can. I know that. That's Elvis Presley in 1957.
Oh, yeah.
And by the way, we should note, he was talking to a black magazine in segregated America. That's Jet Magazine.
He was talking to Jet Magazine, which was started by John East Johnson. Yeah, that's the Jet Magazine. But also,
and so he's saying it's Fats Domino.
But this is another quote from Fats Domino himself. He says, well, what they call rock and roll now is rhythm and blues. I've been playing it for 15 years in New Orleans.
Well, by the way, I grew up listening to segregated radio. So if I went down the dial to the far end where you had to have a minute touch, I could listen to songs like that he did, like I Hear You Knockin', which I loved that, and I was a teeny little guy. But so you definitely the music was there, but it was segregated music.
I remember listening to Los Angeles radio. It was segregated music, and to give you another thing that's very ironic about the segregated music is like our DJ in Los Angeles, the biggest DJ that we had was called Hunter Hancock in Los Angeles, and he was a Euro-American.
Mm-hmm.
And then you had Johnny Otis, and everybody thought Johnny Otis was of African origin, but you know Johnny Otis was Greek. But it was all, yeah, the radio, and it was always on the dial, on the AM dial, on the same place, you know, at the end of the dial, the weakest part, and that was mm-hmm. L.A., San Francisco, that was Detroit, Buffalo, New York, mm-hmm. New Orleans, Miami, Florida, mm-hmm. anywhere you go, that was the name of the game.
Yeah, this is Otis Richmond, the bluesologist, and you can just write Norman Richmond. Otis Richmond, you'll find all of his work and radio work. You met him. Was he a Louisiana guy to you? Had he changed? What was he like to you? What was your impression?
It was like, you know, it's like meeting one of your uncles. He was very. I remember Bob Marley used to bring his own cook, but Fats Domino did that before Bob, you know. And Bob Marley was a big fan of Fats Domino. But anyway, yeah, he brought his own. He was very international in terms of his audience, but he was very his food and the things that he liked were. He was a homeboy. I mean, yeah. He was really
sort of a New Orleans nationalist,
Louisiana culture.
Mm-hmm. Well, can you?
I mean, deeply tied to it.
Yeah, and speaking of that, what is this story about they call the left-handed piano of people from New Orleans, and particularly him?
Well, the left-handed piano is there's a certain thing that you do with the left hand of the piano, and it's New Orleans. But I know Randy Weston is a great pianist who plays. What he calls his music is African rhythm. That left-handed piano thing is a certain sound that you can get. And I remember Leonard Johnson, who used to own a Third World Bookstore, used to always talk about when he would listen to music, he would always talk about, I can hear that left hand. But it's a New Orleans. The left hand is on a certain side of the piano. And you get a certain sound. And Fats Domino, New Orleans, I mean, who was the other guy? Professor Longhair. I had an interview with Professor Longhair, and I remember I lost it. Professor Longhair was one of the people that influenced Fats Domino. You had Allison Toussaint. I mean, and I could go on for days and days talking about the piano players or the left-handed piano players or left-handed style of piano players from New Orleans.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Some people also compare him to Fats Waller.
Oh, Fats Waller.
How come all these guys are fat? We'll get to that sometime. Uh-huh. They say he liked his fat. He didn't like being in New York where they cut the fat off the meat. He said he wanted to go back to New Orleans where they knew how to cook.
Oh, yeah. I was looking at that when he said he ordered a steak and they took the fat off of the steak and he was up. That's why I say he brought his own. He had his own cooking. Like I say, Bob Marley had the same thing. If you ever saw Bob Marley and in Bob Marley's room, he hired, when he started touring and the bigger he got, he brought his own chef. In fact, he did the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, where would you place him? Everybody's always looking for the father and mother of rock and roll, but Elvis certainly gave him a great. That was a great confession on the part of Elvis to name Fats Domino. But when you think of him and his influence, where do you put him? With all, there's so many wonderful names.
Well, I put him at that. Well, in terms of, if you look at him in terms of record sales, and I don't necessarily judge people by record sales, but let's just look at it from a record sales point of view. After Elvis, it was Fats, and Fats sold more records than Chuck Berry, Little Richard combined.
That's sense.
And he was influential. Like I did a radio show yesterday, and Vladimir Putin sang Blueberry Hill.
That's something.
Yeah. Yellow Man from Jamaica sang Blueberry Hill. Supercat, one of my favorite artists from Jamaica, he did Hey Josephine. You had the jazz artist that did his song. I guess Blueberry Hill was I think that was done by Bing Crosby or somebody. But he heard Satchmo do.
Please
it.
Don't say but Pat Boone. We're banning the name on.
but the thing about it was that Satchmo heard what's his name? That's heard Satchmo do it. That's what he wanted to do.
I wonder if those two men ever met. I know it's out of the question, out of the blue, but here are the two biggest names of New Orleans culture.
They would have to have met. I'm going to go back and do a Google search, and there has to be pictures of them because Satchmo lived till the 70s or yeah. Yeah. So no, they would have had to have met.
Yeah, and they would have thoughts about each other. It's just amazing. By the way, when we're talking about cultural icons, the biographers and everybody else ought to get busy. This is ridiculous. These are giants. If you're they're taking down Confederate statues. They want to put up some new ones. Put up Satchmo and put up
That's Domino.
Antoine Dominique. Domino. Otis, we really appreciate you taking the time. And we got to come back and do some more on this. And please go find that tape. That thing is gold.
Oh, yeah.
Thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Take care.
Bye-bye. I think we have a little more of Fats Domino. This is called Fat Man. We'll be right back. Ed, welcome to the Taylor Report. It's CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. And with me is Phil Conan, Classical Underground, Wednesdays 6 to 8. How are you doing, Phil?
Yes, good afternoon, Phil. I'm good.
We can tell people we have an early bird donations to CIUT. Next week, by the way, the 13th, we will be here at 5 o'clock, and we will be asking to become a member, urging you to join up to support the great little station, CIUT. And if you want to go to it, CIUT.fm, you can start donating now. Don't.
And then you can donate some more next week.
And next week even more. That's right, as your income increases. Today we're going to talk to David Jacobs, a Toronto lawyer, about the this new act passed by Parliament. I call it the Sanctions of Putin, actually, would be the better name for it. It's got another name. We'll get into that. And then at the halfway point, we will be talking to Zafar Benghash about the exciting developments of all things inside the monarchy of Saudi Arabia. And as we're going to have to cover a lot of territory because the ground is shaking in that region. And so Zafar Benghash and David Jacobs. And David Jacobs is with us now. Are you there, David?
I am here. How are you?
Very well. David, by the way, congratulations on I saw you were featured in an interview at Black Agenda Report and Counterpunch with the Berkeley journalist Anne Garrison regarding the decision by Burundi to pull out of the International Criminal Court. And it's a very dramatic story. I hope people go to it. It was published November, I think, 2nd in the Black Agenda Report, November 3rd in Counterpunch. I think both journals recognize this is a very important development. This is the first African nation to make this decision. But I your interview indicated there will probably be more. Did you get that right?
Yeah, I think so. What had happened is that the South African government wrote that it was going to pull out, and it had given various reasons for doing it. One, that they didn't think their government was being respected by the International Criminal Court. Two, the International Criminal Court had gone and the prosecution anyway had sought the extradition of the president of Sudan, Omar Bashir, while he was attending a meeting in South Africa, and the South African government said, well, we're not going to do that because, we're involved in all sorts of things, including peace negotiations, and really help peace negotiations to arrest somebody. And on top of that, they said that there's a provision in the Rome Statute, which is a foundation legislation for the International Criminal Court, that in these circumstances allows a consultation between the International Criminal Court and the government, in respect of these extraditions. So the South African government had asked for consultation, instead of which the prosecution simply moved to try to have President Bashir arrested. And the South Africans thought that was intolerable, and was their deputy justice minister said that this smacked of colonialism, and they weren't going to stand it. Now, what happened?
Smacked is an unnecessary word, I guess.
Well, that's actually my paraphrase of what he said. He went on to some details, saying that this.
Well, David, you have a lawyer. People should know you've practiced. You've been to The Hague, and of course, you defended clients at the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda.
Yep.
And it is striking, is it not? And we'll move on to the other subject, but I want to make sure we underline this. Just how high-handed and arrogant this little bitty brand-new court is. They were acting like the whole world belonged to them.
Yes, and, the South African government, among others, wouldn't stand for it. Now, you'll see press reports saying that the South African government has withdrawn its demand to withdraw, if I can put it that way, from the ICC. But if you look at it closely, what's happened, and there seems to be a tug of war between the courts and the government on this. So the courts have now said that the government has to seek parliamentary approval rather than do this by way of a governmental notice that it wishes to withdraw. So as far as I know, it's on hold at the moment, their withdrawal. because of the rulings of the courts. And again, there was a struggle between the courts and the government on the extradition of Bashir. So that'll play out, I'm sure.
And by the way, when you say play out, while all this little shuffling and dance was going on, Bashir went from being public enemy number one to being now okay by the U.S., and they've taken him off their list of bad guys.
Yeah, that makes one believe that...
so if he'd been picked up,
International Criminal Court would be less excited about him. I mean, there's a lot of hand-wringing in the Western press about what Burundi has done. They aren't hand-wringing so much about the fact that of 10 active cases have been active for the ICC, 9 involve Africans, and people seem to notice that there are large-scale breaches of international law committed by rather big and non-African powers, such as the United States and Great Britain. Even the British House of Commons recognized that the attack on Libya was full of all kinds of grotesque illegalities. Mm-hmm. That doesn't seem to have come to the attention of the prosecution there. Happily indicted Muammar Gaddafi and his family in the midst of what was obviously an illegal attack on Syria by a U.S.-led coalition.
Yes.
On Libya, I apologize.
Yeah, so Burundi, then, is standing up for Africa by its taking this stand. It's a dramatic development. I do urge people, go to read the Ann Garrison interview with David Jacobs, Black Agenda Report and Counterpunch. And it's November 2nd, 3rd, if you'll help with the search. And by now you've found it while I'm still trying to think of the date. This is the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. David, this thing of there's what I'm calling the Putin sanctions legislation, very popular now. In the United States Congress in 2012 passed a piece of legislation, and attached to it was called the Magnitsky Act. By the way, I'm interested in the fact that four senators did not vote for it. One of those four was Bernie Sanders. People here seem to love Bernie, but they also hear they like the Magnitsky Act. They haven't asked themselves, why didn't Bernie vote for it? And I think something like 20 members of the United States Congress. And the reason I mention that is that now the same legislation, basically, and concept has come to the Canadian Parliament. And it turned into a show of class solidarity or multi-party loving solidarity, the NDP, the Liberal Party, the Bloc, the Conservatives, and probably the Green, singular, voted for it, this act, which says that we should sanction, gives the power of government, the government power to sanction Russian, various individual Russians, for something that happened, the death of an individual in Russia in 2009. It strikes me as crazy. I don't understand why nobody in Parliament debated this and wondered what the heck is going on. Can you tell us, by the way, what the heck is going on?
But timing is everything, right? As in politics and comedy, I guess. And this is a kind of a grotesque mixture of both, I think. So Magnitsky dies in prison in 2009, and there's no doubt about that. But then this legislation comes through years later. So it comes through in and the proper name of the act in the United States is the Russia and Moldova Jackson-Vanik Repeal and Sergei Magnitsky Rule of Law Accountability Act of 2012. Now, wrap your mind around that. The Russians call this propaganda and part of an anti-Russian campaign. So if you sort of think about the timelines, the ramping up of this sort of extreme anti-Russia hysteria in the United States happens sort of coinciding with this around this time. And, of course, now if any of you, your listeners turn on CNN, MSNBC, BBC, CBC at almost any hour of the day or night, you'll see lurid stories about Russia, which rival anything we heard during the Cold War or, frankly, before. You can say anything you like about Russia. So we're told Magnitsky was a lawyer who exposed corruption, who was beaten to death in jail. It appears that none of those things may be actually true, according to no less an authority than Wikipedia. Magnitsky was a tax accountant. Certainly, according to people who've looked into these things more deeply, they say, well, he was an accountant. And so he died in 2009, but this was in the midst of a lengthy tax fraud investigation of Browder and Browder's companies, Bill Browder, that is, who was the head of something called Hermitage Capital.
Yep, Hermitage Capital Management. By the way, how do we end up with a hero, a hedge fund billionaire, who gave up his U.S. citizenship so he wouldn't have to pay taxes, become this clean, idealist leader of the great cause of bringing human rights to Russia?
Well, that's one point. You make a great point there, because that's a
hedge fund.
That's a fact, and we can find it on the internet, CBS, and so on. That Bill Browder renounced his U.S. citizenship in, I think, in the 90s, 1998, I believe.
1998.
Yeah, 1998.
According to the U.S. government.
Yes, because he was becoming subject to taxation for his offshore accounts. So he didn't like that. So he's a hedge fund manager, and we toss that term around, but a hedge fund is a highly dubious thing, maybe a highly dubious thing. These are investment funds. Now, generally, investment funds are subject to regulation. We can argue about how effective or serious that regulation is, but it is. And in Canada, we have, and in the U.S., we have some securities commissions, which have a lot of requirements for investments, for public offerings and prospectuses and so on. However, hedge funds operate outside it. They operate in a kind of twilight. They are deliberately used to avoid regulatory oversight. They bypass licensing requirements applicable to investment companies. They operate with a lot of flexibility.
They're too big to be watched.
That's right. They're different from mutual funds or other investment funds. And they have their own rules about who can actually invest in them. I mean, assuming you or I had sufficient money to want to invest in these things, it's not an open door. It's not like investing in the stock market or something like that, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this is already something which is quite dubious. He had amassed a huge fortune in the wake of the collapse of the Soviet Union, where there was a massive sell-off of public assets.
Yeah, the hedge fund people, particularly U.S. capital, according to U.S. capital itself, moved into Russia like locusts.
Like locusts. And notwithstanding that at some point, forgive me for not knowing at which point or how the Russian laws worked, was that investments in these companies were restricted to Russians, not foreigners. And one of the problems that they had with Bill Browder and his Hermitage Capital is that he wasn't a Russian. So one of the charges against him was that he essentially bilked the Russian treasury out of hundreds of millions of dollars. And again, this was an investigation which commenced around about 2004 in Russia. That is 5 years before Magnitsky's arrest and death in prison.
Mm-hmm.
What Mr. Browder did is sort of turn the tables and say, well, no, it wasn't me. I didn't defraud the treasury. They defrauded the companies I was involved in. That's why the money didn't get into the treasury. And if you look at his history, he seems to have a habit of aggressively striking first with litigation against people who had claims against him. So if you look at his history, there are a few lawsuits there which have been confidentially settled in circumstances where he's being accused of of all kinds of financial skullduggery. So this is an exceptionally murky thing for us to get into. So you would think that when our parliament was getting into this, they would ask a number of questions themselves, like, well, who's Bill Browder? What's this multi-billionaire doing coming to us and asking for sanctions against a government which is in the process of investigating and, frankly, in the process of indicting him. He was charged. He was indicted. He didn't show up for the trial. And
you can't lose, right? Because everybody's agreed that the greatest demon now, and this is almost like a change of weather, now Putin is totally dubious. So if anybody accuses him, Putin loses.
That's right. And you know, the mantra is that he was beaten to death in a Russian jail. As far as I understand it, the Russians themselves looked into what happened to Magnitsky. He was unwell. It may have been that he was not given proper medical treatment and medication and died. I don't know that it's more than that. And it's what the Russians said. So, for example, the head of the Russian Parliament Committee for Foreign Affairs, a man called Pushkov, has said about this, look, people die in custody under suspicious circumstances. Human rights are violated all over the world, including in the U.S. and U.S. allies and Saudi Arabia and so on.
But Guantanamo, which, of course, is an integral part of the United States. I forget what state it's a member of, but
we're talking about
foreigners
the United States,
being held
which has the largest prison population on an absolute and per capita basis of any country that we're ever aware of in history. Maybe with the exception of, I don't know, I hate to do these comparisons, but I'm not sure of the statistics for during World War II for the Axis countries. But certainly today, it's just tremendously hypocritical. But I don't think we should lose sight of the fact that there is a political goal behind this. So, for example, when the Canadian and the U.S. government says, oh, you know, we're going to have sanctions against people who are involved in criminal behavior, we're going to stop either government from doing that under current criminal laws. So why do we need to embellish this with a law which has got such a fancy name, the Russia, Moldova, and Sergei Magnitsky, rule of law? Why do we need to do that? Because, again, you want to say that Russia is capable of absolutely any monstrosity and just repeat it and repeat it and repeat it. It's just the way we're repeating now the meaningless phrase that Russia hacked the elections.
Yes.
So all of it.
Well, everybody knows that now.
It's
now official because all the comedians and late night have agreed. So I mean, that's like the Supreme Court.
It's one of those big lies which you repeat and repeat and repeat until it becomes a fact. Right?
Yeah. I was just struck. I mean, again, I mean, what got me was that, as I say, Bernie Sanders voted against. And here he's revered. I saw him he was on the University of Toronto campus and they were hanging from the windows to listen. He at least exercised his power as a senator, didn't go along. And The Nation magazine, again, a respected liberal journal, they've written about this in the New Republic, and both of them, they wrote skeptical articles about what all this is about, basically identifying it as Russophobic, but also pretty much violating how international relations are supposed to be conducted. I think it was Stephen Cohen, who knows something about Russia. Of course, he's now on the banned list, but a Princeton professor. He said that, you know, you're supposed to go by some kinds of law. There isn't – he says you can't rely – you can't say an NGO reports, therefore my government's going to sanction another government. What's an NGO know about it? I mean, did anybody go into a court and examine that NGO and ask how they came by the information, how reliable it is, who the sources? They simply – and they have these entities like Human Rights Watch or Amnesty – both of which receive funding from the British government, the American government, and as though there's some sort of sanctimonious body that cannot be questioned.
Well, what's astonishing, of course, is what we choose to believe and what we choose not to believe. I mean, obviously, more often than not, these NGOs are extensions of American intelligence or Canadian intelligence, assuming those things are not contradictions.
Well, Parliament has no intelligence.
That's right. But what's what's even more disturbing, Browder, of course, likes to, notwithstanding the fact that he appears to love U.S. democracy, at least from a distance.
Now that he's given it up.
Now he's given it up.
Yes.
He moves with absolute speed and power and money to shut down anyone who's going to be critical of him. So there are two important examples. One is a man called Alex Kreiner, K-R-A-I-N-E-R, who's written a book. And the book is called...
The Killing of William Browder,
Deconstructing Bill Browder's Dangerous Deception. And he's somebody who's done an investigation and came to the conclusion that the Browder's stories were all incorrect. I mean, just to take some relatively small examples, I mean, Browder says that Magnitsky was posthumously tried on trumped-up charges and convicted. That's not what happened. He hasn't been posthumously tried. His case remained open only because Magnitsky's mother, on the urging of Bill Browder, told the state not to shut down the case simply because Magnitsky had died. Browder himself, though, was tried and convicted. So there was no trial of Magnitsky, and Browder was convicted of fraud and tax avoidance. But what's happened? Can you get Kreiner's book? So he's complained that his book is now being banned by Amazon. And I must say, I myself tried to find it on Amazon and couldn't. So there's that. There's another story, though, which is even more, well, at least as disturbing. There's a man called Nekrasov, a Russian filmmaker. Not a fan of the Russian government. He considered himself many years a dissident and a friend of Bill Browder. Browder and he got together to make a film about what had happened to Magnitsky, and according to Nekrasov, he went in there fully expecting the story would bear out. But in repeated conversations with Browder, because Browder kept contradicting himself about the story, and Nekrasov looked into it, and reluctantly, as far as I know, from at least listening to interviews with Nekrasov, decided that the Russian government's version of events was correct and that Bill Browder's was not correct. However, it's been near impossible to see Nekrasov's film.
You know, by the way, and I have to say something I know about that, and you may know, and I'll ask you to elaborate too on this, is that they showed the film. The only place it's been shown where it got a kind of a appropriate, respectful opportunity to be seen and talked about in Washington, D.C., and the host of the evening was Seymour Hersh.
That's right. Yes. Seymour Hersh, very
so
well respected.
Circle Hersh's name. He's, you know, can't be trusted anymore.
Yeah. Well, there you go. But you know, we're told that
we're the freest society ever. That's why we can't see these films.
We're not autocratic at all. But Nekrasov film can't get shown in Europe, in the UK, as far as I understand it. I've tried to find it on YouTube. And I get some very strange, where you actually find it, you actually get some very strange notice saying that you can't look at it. So
can't look at it that way.
Yeah, yeah. And that's YouTube. And, you know, if,
this is like the old paranoid 50s. I remember once going in a bookstore and it was selling poetry mainly, but I heard they had left books there. And I asked about, and the guy wanted to know how I found out that they had these books. And I said, I'm sorry, I wasn't supposed to know. Went back out on the street. Anyway, no, they've created this paranoid atmosphere. It seems to me that the fact that all of Parliament voted one way and then they all loved each other and hugged and waved at the members of the Russian family in the gallery shows that they are terrified. They're what I call the petrified forest, Canadian Parliament, petrified with fear. That they're unanimous. At least the Americans still have guys who say, "Well, I'm from out of town and I'm not voting for this." But in this case, Bernie Sanders, you know, I keep bringing his name up because he's supposed to be a saint now, and he didn't think it was a great idea.
Yeah, I mean,
One last thing, Dave, I want to make sure I mention it. I don't know if you're aware of this, but when that bill was introduced, that was in 2012, and the point of the bill was to increase and liberalize trade with Russia. That's why they attached the act to it, which said, we're still putting you on notice. We think you're bad. It was like, and so Obama had to sign something, which was, it was a bill that contradicted itself. On the one hand, wider trade. On the other hand, we reserve the right to name people in your country that we think are human rights abusers and create havoc for you. Kind of a nightmare. By the way, we should remind everybody, John McCain is the father of the original bill.
That was certainly the complaint about...
The founding father.
The complaint about this in Russia. They said, well, you know, you want to have more trade with us on the one hand. On the other hand, you're hanging this over our heads, you know. The Russian parliament has called this a hypocritical, empty bill and harmful because it serves to worsen relations between Moscow and Washington.
By the way, why does Canada want to do this? If Freeland and others went to the meeting talking about free trade, Mexico, Canada, the U.S., and Trump's response was to urinate into the salad, you know, it was like and they all went along with that. And they pass laws that he wants passed. I mean, that this kind of damaging legislation, ridiculous.
Well, you have to think of what's happening in the Canadian Parliament. Last year, we had Stéphane Dion as a foreign minister, who was lukewarm, not to mention critical of passing the Magnitsky Act. He was looking to try and mend fences to some extent with Russia. He was unceremoniously kicked in the rear end out of his office to make way for Chrystia Freeland, who is well known for her Russophobia. She's persona non grata.
Those are her credentials.
That's right. She's persona non grata.
What does she do best? She can curse them in their own language.
That's so right.
She's a great advance.
She's somebody who...
We're so proud of her.
She's somebody who without shame, can tell the media that... reports about her Nazi grandfather were Russian disinformation when these reports were information which came from the archives of the government of Alberta, not well known as a Russian suburb.
Well, at least her grandfather left them there for everybody to read.
Yeah. I do recommend proud of his work. Just to go back to the Nekrasov film, there's a few articles you can find on the internet by Gilbert Doctorow is one, and the other there's an article called A Blacklisted Film in the New
Cold War. Well, Robert Perry, Consortium News, talks about it as well.
That's right. I was just kidding. That's his article, A Blacklisted Film in the New Cold War. That's Robert Perry, Consortium News, August 2 of 2017. It's well worth reading, you know.
Well, David, we've taken up a lot of your time. You covered the ground nicely. We really do appreciate it. And
Thank you.
I hope everybody goes to Counterpunch and Black Agenda Report, read the interview done with you by the Berkeley journalist and Garrison.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. We're on SoundCloud, The Taylor Report, and we are facebook.com/Taylor-Report. And so we're a hyphen on Facebook, and we are The Taylor Report. I guess we'll take a break. That's the least we could do, and we'll be back. We'll be right back.
listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jamal's radio essay.
Dennis Banks, warrior for Indian rights, presente. In the late 1960s and early 1970s, two names emerged from the Native American and indigenous community that stood for resistance to white repression and assaults on Native life, Russell Means and Dennis Banks. They were men who lived, at times, in urban America and experienced its impoverishment as well as its penchant for broken dreams. In a time of mass resistance and social upheaval shown by the anti-war and black liberation movements, Banks was among thousands of young activists of Native indigenous communities who rose up to speak and act on behalf of the oppressed. In 1968, after leaving prison, Banks joined forces with Clyde Belcourt to found the American Indian Movement, AIM, which sought to organize scattered Native clan members into a militant, cohesive unit. At its height, it had some 25,000 members. AIM activists held protests at historic sites to draw attention to U.S. massacres of Native peoples, as well as present-day injustices. In 1970, Banks and Means declared a day of mourning to mark Thanksgiving Day, when AIM activists seized the replica ship dubbed the Mayflower 2 in Plymouth, Massachusetts, on TV when real Indians confronted whites in Indian garb. In 1972, a national caravan of hundreds seized the Bureau of Indian Affairs in Washington for a week to protest a long train of broken trees. In 1973, AIM activists led by Banks seized the town of Wounded Knee, South Dakota, the site of the infamous massacre of Indians in 1890. The siege, lasting over 70 days, would become a 20th century hotspot of conflict, armed conflict, between AIM and agents of the U.S. government. In his later years, Banks became an actor, and his striking, chiseled features filled many a screen. He later became an educator in several colleges for Indian youth. On Sunday, October 29th, Dennis Banks, Ojibwe, living in his northern Minnesota Leech Lake Reservation, closed his eyes on the same land where his eyes first opened 80 winters ago. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. Thank you. non-candidate, Marichuy. In Mexico, the existing political structure is a patchwork of corruption. Government is sometimes indistinguishable from the notorious drug cartels. Some will call this rhetoric, but think of this. Remember the students who were slaughtered in the massacre in Ayotzinapa? Think of that. Perhaps that's why indigenous candidates are emerging, to give voice to the millions of people who were there before the Spanish came, to try to right the ship of state. Today, a woman called Marichuy is crossing the country, seeking official registration. But she calls herself a non-candidate, a woman content to be called an indigenous spokesperson. Marichuy, born to her Nahuatl family and named Maria de Jesus Patricio Martinez, is part of a campaign enthusiastically supported by the country's indigenous and others who want change, but also backed by the influential Zapatista Liberation Movement, which has a close relationship with indigenous people. When Marichuy visited Zapatista autonomous communities like Chiapas recently, she was greeted by thousands of indigenous people who encouraged her to run in the 2018 national presidential elections. Marichuy is indeed spokeswoman of the Consejo Indígena Gobierno, or Indigenous Governing Council, representing people in some 17 states. This non-candidate, emerging from the first people of this land, may be just what Mexico needs from imprisoned nations. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. Blockbusters of the last few decades, saying that the executive sexually assaulted or harassed him. Well, it gave birth to Me Too, to quote the hashtag. And it didn't end with Weinstein. A who's who of male Hollywood were outed as sexual abusers. And then, miraculously, the river burst its banks, and the names of nationally known politicians began to fill the air. What we're witnessing is the beginning of a movement, augmented by social media, yes, but also animated by real, live women, as shown by the unprecedented mobilization of women shortly after Trump's unexpected win in the presidency. That's because social movements first change consciousness, then they change society itself. When I was a youth, I heard hints and whispers about the casting couch. It was simply the way things were. How many women accepted such vile treatment on their road to fame and fortune, only to find that everything that glitters ain't gold? Today, because of the courage of such women, we are seeing the extraordinary costs of such a couch. But this time, the men in power are paying the price. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Current signs are there that the Earth is in the midst of the sixth great mass extinction? What impacts are CO2 having on the Earth's atmosphere and oceans? What evidence is there that geoengineering is playing a role in the California wildfire situation? Could deadly UV radiation entering the Earth's atmosphere through a deteriorating ozone layer trigger the end of all higher life forms on Earth? Are national governments part of the solution or part of the problem in remediating the threats facing human existence? On this week's Global Research News Hour, with a high-level climate change conference now underway in Bonn, Germany, we take a closer look at the threats posed to the environment by human activities and what, if anything, can be done to remedy the situation. We'll hear from investigative journalist and climate change writer Dar Jamail on the current indicators. We'll hear from researcher Dane Wigington on clandestine geoengineering activities, and we'll hear brief excerpts of a conversation with a researcher investigating UV radiation penetration of the ozone layer. On this week's program, clear and present dangers, climate collapse, geoengineering, and the ozone hole. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of November 10th, 2017. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. A new United Nations-sponsored report on the April 4th sarin incident in an al-Qaeda-controlled town in Syria blames Bashar al-Assad's government for the atrocity, but the report contains evidence deep inside its Annex 2 that would prove Assad's innocence. If you read that far, you would find that more than 100 victims of sarin exposure were taken to several area hospitals before the alleged Syrian warplane could have struck the town of Khan Shaykhun. Still, the Joint Investigative Mechanism, or JIM, a joint project of the UN and the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, brushed aside this startling evidence and delivered the Assad guilty verdict that the United States and its allies wanted. The JIM consigned the evidence of a staged atrocity in which al-Qaeda operatives would have used sarin to kill innocent civilians and pin the blame on Assad to a spot 14 pages into the report's Annex 2. The sensitivity of this evidence of a staged attack is heightened by the fact that President Trump rushed to judgment and ordered a retaliatory strike with 59 Tomahawk missiles on a Syrian airbase on the night of April 6th to 7th. That comes from the article, Did Al-Qaeda Dupe Trump on Syrian Attack? By Robert Perry, posted November 10th, originally appearing at Consortium News. GM rice accounted for about a third of contamination cases, despite the fact that there is officially no GM rice grown anywhere in the world. They also focused on cases of contamination arising from unauthorized GM crops, those without any authorization for commercial growing anywhere in the world. 9 cases were discovered of GM contamination of these unauthorized, non-commercialized GM crops that haven't undergone any environmental or food safety analysis. The authors argue that once GM contamination has happened, it can be difficult to contain. Don Westfall, biotech industry consultant and vice president of Promar International back in 2001, was at the time quoted by the Toronto Star on 9th of January 2001 as saying that the hope of the GM industry is that over time the market is so flooded with genetically modified organisms that there's nothing you can do about it. You just sort of surrender. That comes from the article, GM Food Crops Illegally Growing in India, The Criminal Plan to Change the Genetic Core of the Nation's Food System, by Colin Todd Hunter, posted November 10th. NATO needs civilian infrastructure in Europe to meet its growing military requirements, Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said ahead of a meeting in Brussels. This will mean coordination with national governments and the private sector, he added. Defense ministers from the 29 NATO states arrived in Brussels to begin discussions on a revision of the NATO command structure. What is envisioned is a new command to protect sea lines between North America and Europe, and another to, quote, improve the movement of troops and equipment within Europe, unquote. Stoltenberg believes that a revision of NATO's structure is necessary to tackle the alleged threat from Russia. That comes from the article, NATO wants Europe's civilian infrastructure ready for war with Russia. Posted November 10th, originally appearing at RT World News. A As we reported yesterday, the WSJ writes that the country's central bank, the Saudi Arabian Monetary Authority, said late Tuesday that it has frozen the bank accounts of persons of interest and said the move is, quote, in response to the Attorney General's request pending the legal cases against them, unquote. But what is more notable is that while we first suggested jokingly on Monday that the ulterior Saudi motive would be to simply nationalize the net worth of some of Saudi Arabia's wealthiest individuals, now the WSJ confirms that this is precisely the case. And what's more notably is that the amount in question is absolutely staggering, nearly two times Saudi Arabia's total foreign reserves. As the WSJ alleges, quote, the crackdown could also help replenish state coffers. The government has said that assets accumulated through corruption will become state property, and people familiar with the matter say the government estimates the value of assets it can reclaim at up to 3 trillion Saudi rial, or $800 billion. While much of that money remains abroad and invested in various assets from bronze to stocks to precious metals and real estate, which will complicate efforts to reclaim it, even a portion of that amount would help shore up Saudi Arabia's finances. That comes from the article, Real Motive Behind Saudi Purge Emerges, $800 billion in Confiscated Assets by Zero Hedge, posted November 10th. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. The 23rd session of the Conference of the Parties to the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change is now underway and is being held in Bonn, Germany, under the presidency of the government of Fiji, one of the small island states threatened by climate change-induced storms and sea level rise. On the agenda for this conference, an intergovernmental dialogue detailing the ways and means to assist all governments, supported by non-party stakeholders, which may better meet the goals of the Paris Agreement now and over the years and decades to come. This year's conference comes in the wake of yet another year of gloomy news of our dire climate predicament. Massive wildfires, floods, intense hurricanes, and other unprecedented weather events are wreaking havoc on the planet and its dominant species, Homo sapiens. Dar Jamail is a staff writer for Truth Out and the author of several books, including the forthcoming The End of Ice from New Books. He is the recipient of the Martha Gellhorn Award for Investigative Journalism, among other awards. He joins us now from Washington State to elaborate a little bit more on the state of abrupt climate disruption on planet Earth. Welcome, Dar.
Thanks, Michael. Good to be with you.
I was wondering if there are any particular developments over the last 12 months that you think really need to be emphasized in terms of waking up the general population to the extreme urgency of taking responsible action, both at the COP conference and beyond. What would you like to highlight?
Yeah, there's so much. I mean, the challenge would be just, not talking about that fact alone for the rest of our time together. But I think, you know, the extreme hurricane season that we saw, you know, Hurricane Harvey, what happened in Houston, the single largest rain event ever recorded in the history of the United States. I mean, there was enough water on the ground in that region during that time that it literally depressed the Earth's crust several millimeters. This is not normal. Another thing that people need to keep in mind is the devastating wildfire season that we again had out here in the West and throughout much of the rest of the United States, where it's on track to be the second largest wildfire season in history, following, I believe, 2012 was the first. So again, note that how close the records being set are to the previous records. Another thing to note is that this August was the second warmest August ever recorded in history, leaving this year on track to be the third warmest year in recorded history. And also bearing in mind that it's 2017 and 16 of the 17 hottest years ever recorded have happened since 2000. And the last thing I think I would point out to people, it hasn't necessarily happened in just the last year, but to note that of all the warming humans have generated, 93% of that has gone into the oceans. So what we're seeing is just 7% of the warming that we've generated in the atmosphere. So it's important to note that the oceans are holding that warming. And this is a very, very significant factor that we can probably come back to a little bit later in our discussion.
For sure. I'm wondering also if you could comment on just the what we've discovered in terms of the loss of species. I mean, not just species, but like actual animal individuals. There's been a large decline that we've seen just in the last few decades.
That's right. There is a normal extinction background rate. It's somewhere between 1-2%. We're looking at an average extinction rate now of between 150 and 200 species per day. That puts us somewhere over 1,000 times above the normal background extinction rate. We're looking at losses of wildlife and other species, certainly marine life as well, that are, again, just unprecedented in the history since humans have been on the planet. Another thing that happened actually quite recently was a report came out of Germany showing that a huge number of insects, in fact, 3/4 of their entire flying insect population has disappeared in just recent years. And this is something to take note of, because when we talk about the importance of insects in any ecosystem and the role that they play in fertilization and as a food source for different parts of the food chain, if we lose insects, seemingly insignificant to many people, then we are actually in great jeopardy, because, of course, our food supply and the food supply of the greater ecosystem is then in very big trouble. So certainly there are alarm bells sounding throughout the insect and animal kingdom, as well as in the oceans, of the impacts of we've now raised the planetary temperature to roughly 1.1 degrees C above pre-industrial baseline temperatures. So that's something important to keep in mind, and also knowing that we haven't yet really begin to feel the real impacts of the totality of just that amount of warming, given that once you introduce CO2 into the atmosphere, there's a 40-year lag before you feel the full effects of that warming. So that's also important to note, that what we're dealing with now is everything that was emitted up to 40 years ago, and we've emitted more CO2 in the last 40 years than the totality before that.
1.5 degrees was supposed to be that barrier beyond which we dare not cross. And so I think we're on track to go way beyond that. Could you comment on the what's happening at in the Arctic and the Antarctic?
Well, I just spent a significant amount of time up in Alaska over the last couple of summers doing research for the book that I'm working on. And my most recent trip, I went up to Utqiagvik, formerly known as Barrow. It's the northernmost point in Alaska, and it's a significant place for a lot of reasons. One, because it very much is on the front lines of climate disruption, because the permafrost is thawing, as you in Canada are acutely aware of also, across broad swaths of area. And this is causing all kinds of problems for the villagers there, because they're living on top of it. So literally the infrastructure that they depend on is now becoming destabilized, coupled with, as the Arctic sea ice is, summer sea ice is retreating, it's enabling bigger storms and bigger wave action on the coast. And so erosion is a very real problem, coupled with thawing permafrost. And because of this, there's over 30 villages in Alaska alone that are going to have to be moved flat out, no question about it. And Utqiagvik, being the largest population center on the north slope of Alaska, in the seat of the borough there, it's going to have to be moved. Not as soon as some of the others, but what I saw was, when I was there, is they're already basically having to maintain a giant dirt berm on the north side of the town, right on the edge of the Arctic Ocean, and it's consistently being eroded away by storm action and wave action on it, to the tune where that part of the coast is actually losing 10 feet of coast every year. So at that rate, just from what I saw, given that some of the town's major infrastructure is probably 80 to 90 feet away from the coast, I think it's safe to say that within 10 years, at least part of that village is going to have to be moved. But then, you know, more broadly, the rate of glacier loss happening even across Alaska is again, you know, every year is somewhere in the top 5 to 10 biggest recession years for some of the monitoring that's going on up there by the U.S. Geological Survey. And then also significantly down in the Antarctic, we're seeing pretty frequent reports now of some of the major glacier systems that are literally becoming unplugged, meaning they were grounded enough in the subsea areas where they dump into the ocean off of the continent. And as those melt away, largely helped along by warming seas from underneath, then it literally is unplugging the glaciers. And so they're starting to flow much faster and release themselves into the ocean. And so all of this together, it means bad news for sea level rise as well.
Mm. There was a major paper in the peer-reviewed Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences of the United States from this past spring. Paul Ehrlich and two other researchers, they used the term biological annihilation in the heading. Are you familiar with that document? Could you comment on its significance?
I am, and I've written about that one, and Ehrlich has also played a role in some of the other papers that have come out over the last few years talking about how we are in the Anthropocene, literally a new era on the planet because humans are having such a giant impact across the planet. And they talk about biological annihilation and use that term, which sounds dramatic, and it is dramatic, but I think it's accurate because, again, if you look at the amount of wildlife being lost and the fact that 90% of all the pelagic fish, the large fish in the oceans are already gone. Well over half the wildlife population is already gone. And, you know, some of the things we talked about at the beginning of our conversation, you know, all other impacts to wildlife, you know, and this is happening because of climate disruption impacts, but also human encroachment, loss of habitat, loss of biodiversity. And we are literally killing off species on the planet that we don't even know exist yet. I mean, to, you know, we talk about these extinction rates that we mentioned earlier between 150 and 200 species a day. Some of my book research brought me down to the Amazon. And when I was there, I became aware of a scientific expedition last January where a number of Brazilian scientists were helicoptered into a remote part of the Amazon, and in just 25 days identified more than 80 new species. And that's amazing, but what's also troubling about it is that we're wiping out parts of the Amazon and other tropical forests and other parts of the biosphere, and we're killing off species that we don't even know exist yet. So when it comes, you know, we talk about biological annihilation, and then the threat that that poses to us, ultimately, you know, at some point we're going to need new antibiotics. We're going to need to keep developing new drugs, for example, to stay ahead of diseases as they arise. And yet we're taking out parts of the biosphere that may hold those things that we're going to need. And again, yet we don't even know that they exist yet. So this is another layer to that biological annihilation that is so dangerous, and why it is so important that, you know, this is not a sane way to behave with the planet on which we depend.
Yeah, I mean, when you spoke earlier about the oceans and how they were retaining more heat, another thing that's happening with all the CO2 that's being dumped into the atmosphere is that a lot of it's acidifying the oceans, and that's having an impact. And as I understand it, there's parallels with the last great extinction, the Permian extinction of 252 million years ago. So that's got to be kind of a major beacon call that we should be responding to, no?
Well, that's exactly right, and that's troubling enough on its own. But to take that even a step further, aside from the meteor strike that took out the dinosaurs, every single mass extinction event in the history of Earth was triggered by too much CO2 in the atmosphere. And we are actually injecting more CO2 into the atmosphere faster than occurred during the Permian mass extinction event, because that event took place over 80,000 years. And so for context, we're talking about 250 years. You know, if we assume the Industrial Revolution began in 1750, some people quantify it as starting when agriculture began. But if we're conservative and say 1750, that means in, you know, basically 267 years, we've caused this much change on the planet. And compared to previous mass extinction events, this is, to call it abrupt is to put it mildly.
Now, Dar Jamail, the last time we had this conversation, Barack Obama was president of the United States. And now, of course, Donald Trump is in power, and he's put some a lot of people from the fossil fuel sector in positions of power and influence, even in the Environmental Protection Agency, you know, the kind of a fossil fuel fox watching that hen house. And other initiatives, Keystone XL, at pulling out of this the Paris Accord. You know, I mean, in a sense, he's literally throwing fuel on the fire that is global climate change. Are there any significant aspects of what Trump has done and is doing that we really need to be focusing our attention on?
Well, you really lined it out. I mean, you know, appointing Scott Pruitt, you know, former attorney general for Oklahoma, who sued the EPA half a dozen times. I mean, this is a guy literally tasked with dismantling the EPA. And so by Trump placing him atop that, as he's done with Rick Perry, as head of the Interior, Department of Energy, and then Zinke is head of the Department of Interior. I mean, go on down the entire list. He's literally chosen the perfect person to disassemble each of these institutions and place them on top of it. Again, you know, the reports coming out, you know, with Tillerson, you know, basically former head of ExxonMobil as the Secretary of State. In addition to everything you just lined out and what I just added to it, it couldn't be more clear. This is basically a free-for-all for the fossil fuel industry in this country now. And the U.S., you know, as Syria recently signing on to the climate treaty, the U.S. now being the only country on the planet of having that distinction of not being signed on to the Paris Accords. And so it's pathetic. It's terrifying. It's maddening. But this is basically a mad dog administration that is, you know, it's basically death throes of the empire. We're going to try to gobble up as much as we can on the way out is what's happening. And if you look at it through the lens of what's happening to the planet through with the climate, it is worst case scenario. I mean, this is a time where as bad as the Trump administration is and horrendous in all the ways we just outlined for the climate, we need to be having literally the polar opposite response if we were going to have any hope just in mitigating what's already going to be happening. I think even the general discussion has long since accepted that there's no stopping it. And that's pretty shocking that even in the mainstream, we're at that point where the average person understands there's no stopping this situation. The best hope is how much can we mitigate it? But now looking at the U.S. being one of the not just largest CO2 emitters on the planet, but the role that we play in promoting fossil fuel development around the planet, you know, and being in so in cahoots with Russia, et cetera, this does not bode well.
I know that over the years that I've been a political watcher and hosting programs like this one, I've developed, a certain amount of cynicism about a lot of the activities of elected politicians, or at least the political system at large, regardless of the earnestness of the individual representatives. And I tend to think that if it's not making money for certain powerful people, your political initiative isn't going to that's pretty much the main driver of the system, not people lobbying their member of parliament or their member of Congress or whatever. So you know, taking that to the COP conference, even though you have individuals out there and as a part of a kind of a counter delegation in the United a U.S. counter delegation, I believe, California Governor Jerry Brown is there, and other people who are trying to who are basically saying that we're going to continue engaging at the city and state level and so on. So I'm wondering what your thoughts are about people who really want to take some meaningful action, where they should be centering their attention. Does it make sense to engage these representatives, or should we be more focused on just, building an alternative, community gardens or what have you? Where do you sit on that? Where can you get the most bang for your ecological buck, if I could put it that way?
Well, I think you really just hit the nail on the head. I think that if you really want to enact something tangible that you can see have some immediate benefits, certainly in the United States now with this so-called administration, the only solutions are going to be on a local level. And for me personally, locally, I mean literally, what am I doing with my own carbon footprint? What am I doing where I live? What am I doing with how much of my own food am I growing instead of buying? How much do I drive? How much do I fly? I mean, on that level, and then branching out. And, I think if people can bring a few more people into the fold and get them to be really aware of the crisis that we're in and what needs to happen and just start there, I think that's what we can have that's where we can see some results. And then, possibly on a local level, like I live in a small town that's pretty open to making positive changes in these ways. And we're seeing a big expansion of the use of, of the amount of solar being installed around here, et cetera. So in that way, locally, there can still be a lot of good things happen. But yeah, I think wasting time to try to get someone elected on a federal level in this country that's really going to take this bull by the horns the way it needs to be handled is literally a waste of energy. I mean, I wouldn't dissuade if someone's hell bent on trying to go after, the corrupt politicians and expose them and kind of take some activism in that way. I applaud that. I'm certainly not going to try to dissuade anyone from doing that. But I think for positive results on a local level, it's pretty easy to find them and it's pretty easy to enact them. And I think that, we have to do that, at least me personally. Otherwise, I get completely dispirited, given everything that we've just discussed.
Darji Mail, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
We've been speaking with Darji Mail. He is an investigative journalist, an award-winning investigative journalist. His regular climate dispatches appear at truthout.org. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. One component of the puzzle of weather weirdness affecting the globe is geoengineering. Last month, representatives of U.S.-based groups seeking to put a halt to suspected geoengineering programs filed a lawsuit against the Department of Commerce, which oversees the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, for what they claim are the failure of the NOAA to respond to Freedom of Information requests regarding past and ongoing weather modification activities. My next guest has devoted thousands of hours researching, documenting, and alerting the general public to these programs, which officialdom refuses to acknowledge. His name is Dane Wigington. He's the lead researcher for www.geoengineeringwatch.org and has investigated all levels of geoengineering, from stratospheric aerosol geoengineering to solar radiation management to ionosphere heater facilities like HARP. He is a past guest of this program and joins us now from his off-grid home in Shasta County, California. Welcome back to the program, Dane.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you for all your work at Global Research and for your group's continued focus on the critical climate engineering issue.
It's been a while since we had you on the show. Lots to discuss. Perhaps we should start with this lawsuit. Is this the first time you've launched a legal action against the government with regard to the geoengineering issue?
Well, there's a part of our legal effort in Canada. We filed there in February of last year. That suit is still ongoing, although getting great resistance from the Canadian government, of course. And here, this is the first legal action taken in the U.S. that I'm aware of, and this is simply a step toward a larger legal action. But what we're getting from organizations like NOAA, a complete stonewalling. And in fact, the response to our Freedom of Information Act request on any information with any weather modification programs was basically a paragraph that said, we don't know anything about any weather modification ever in the U.S., which is completely absurd because they're required to sign off on several hundred state and regional smaller scale weather modification programs every single year. They're on every federal document we have, and they deny that. So this is clearly an all-out effort by the power structure to hide, for obvious reasons, the illegal ongoing global climate engineering operations that have done unimaginable decimation all over the globe, contaminated every breath we take. And really, at this point, Michael, I would argue this point, and I don't think anybody could dispute this, there can be no legitimate discussion about the climate without including climate engineering. And that's something that everybody from every side of the fence should agree on.
Mm. Now, Dane, you've documented quite a bit on your website, geoengineeringwatch.org. For curious and skeptical listeners who may need a quick hit, are there one or two key documents in particular that they really need to peruse that should convince them that these activities are indeed happening and not some sort of, you know, groundless conspiracy theory?
Certainly. I would advise two pieces of data to prove beyond any reasonable doubt that these programs are real and ongoing. One, they can search our site for massive Senate document, or they can search on any search engine, geoengineeringwatch.org, massive Senate document. They can find a 750-page Senate document with the most key pages exerted and highlighted in that post that prove beyond any shadow of a doubt, this document was from 1978 that stated the programs had been ongoing at that point for over three decades. It states all the agencies involved. It states that there would be cooperation between otherwise opposing governments, i.e. China, Russia, that they all cooperate on this issue because of the cross-border ramifications. Obviously, you can't just geoengineer over your own country and not have it affect everybody else down the line. So this document also states the need for total immunity for anyone and everyone, total immunity from prosecution for anyone and everyone involved in these programs. It's an extremely damning document. One I would recommend people look at in depth, at least beginning with our excerpts, film footage. When we have film footage of military aircraft and commercial with what can only be considered sprayed aerosol dispersions turning on and off with nozzles visible, end of the argument. There's no speculation here. This is going on. And we have the primary elements named in climate engineering patents showing up in lab tests all over the globe in our air column because it's in the precipitation, starting with aluminum and barium, there's nothing to discuss. This is absolutely going on. And the fact that we live in a world in which the entirety of academia, because they're being threatened or paid to deceive the population to hide this issue, it's truly astounding we live in such an Orwellian world when this elephant in the room can be going on in our skies, blotting out the sun, because we have global dimming, Michael. You know what? You've heard the term global
absolutely,
dimming.
Absolutely, yes.
Sure. So I know you're very familiar with this issue as well. So when we have global dimming at 20 to 30%, the express goal of solar radiation management, I mean, there is so much documentation, film footage to corroborate this. We have photographs of the nozzles mounted on commercial aircraft, nozzles mounted on the pylons, aimed into the exhaust jet stream to make this look like quote-unquote condensation. So bottom line, from government documents, of which there's many, I named one, to film footage, to mountains of other corroborating documents and data, there's no question this is going on.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I just looking up at the sky on a couple of bright, clear days, and I saw these
trails that they look like a tic-tac-toe board. And I'm wondering, is that interesting little that those flight plans would align just that way? So, I mean, it kind of makes me wonder, you know. But just to kind of, you know, maybe putting forward a bit of a skeptical point, if I could, when you talk about global dimming, I mean, there are other pollution sources on the planet. How?
Certainly. I don't mean to negate those. I mean, any form of particulate pollution is going to add to the global dimming equation, no question. I definitely don't want to paint it this or that. There's many, many factors affecting our environment, our climate, but mathematically speaking, the single greatest factor is the intentional climate intervention programs. And we can correlate this with our solar power uptake, which is what got me onto this issue. That's my background with Bechtel Power. I have a large off-grid home, and that's what alerted me to this issue. I was losing tremendous amounts of my solar PV uptake from strictly whatever the aircraft were emitting, and I mean 60, 70, 80% on some days. So when you consider an 80% decline from a sky or solar power uptake from a sky that's completely obscured from no natural cloud cover whatsoever, that's a profound amount of incoming solar UV or solar thermal energy to block. That's a profound amount. So the ability to block the sun to an immense degree is absolutely difficult to comprehend, and it takes a tremendous amount of materials to do that. And we know from the world's most recognized geoengineers like Dr. David Keith, who's been on the Colbert Report and many other programs, he's the face of geoengineering for the power structure, stating their annual goal of putting 20 million tons of aluminum into the atmosphere every single year. And your listeners can look that up, Michael. If they search Dane Wigington, David Keith, they can see me confronting Dr. Keith at an international geoengineering conference where, after the symposium he gave proposing putting 20 million tons of aluminum into the atmosphere every single year, I asked him, had any studies been done whatsoever on the toxicological effects, environmental toxicity? He tried to dodge the question by stating, paraphrasing, there's a lot of material in the air already, a little more won't hurt. And when I reiterated my question, that material is not aluminum. You're proposing 20 million tons of aluminum. And he, if you can imagine, from the world's most recognized geoengineer stating, we haven't studied that at all. Could terrible things happen tomorrow? That's about a verbatim of what he said. We don't know. We don't know. Mm. That's the kind of attitude you have with climate engineering, just like you had with the detonation of nuclear bombs. They do it because they can, because the population is not willing to face this issue and stop them.
I wanted to raise, I want to kind of get back to that. You touched on something I hope to get back to in a minute, but I wanted to just sort of move over to the wildfires situation, the drought, and what, you know, some of the thoughts that you've raised about the nature of these wildfires and, you know, what leads you to believe that there's more to this than the normal, say, CO2-driven climate changes that that we would expect under existing models. I mean, what are there telltale signs that there's some geoengineering fallout, you know, literally or figuratively speaking, that's contributing to these, you know, the wildfires and other phenomena?
I would argue not just telltale signs, but inarguable proof of the connection. And if your listeners search engineered drought catastrophe, target California, they'll find that for a number of years at geoengineeringwatch.org, we've been documenting with satellite imagery the ongoing aerosol spraying assault that helps in conjunction with the ionosphere heaters like HARP. For your listeners, most of your listeners probably know what that is, but those are massively powerful ground-based radio frequency microwave transmitters that can and do heat the ionosphere, creating high-pressure zones like the ridiculously resilient ridge. That's the meteorological term coined for the ridge that's been parked over the U.S. West for 10 years almost consistently, which blocks incoming precipitation. There's a number of reasons we feel they're doing this. I can go into that in more detail in a moment, but also, off the coast, in the eastern Pacific, which is off the U.S. West Coast, we have satellite imagery of blanket grid pattern aerosol spraying almost constantly, which prohibits the normal low-pressure storm circulations from forming that then butt up against the ridge of high pressure anyway, and it keeps the precipitation from flowing inland. And in regards to the drought-causing capability of climate engineering, it's not just us saying this. We have countries in the Middle East, and I'll leave this back into California in a moment, but countries stating on the floor of the UN, the United Nations, that their country is being droughted out by NATO climate modification programs, like the leader of Iran on the floor of the UN. Your listeners can look this up online. They have sophisticated technology, radar, military. They know what's happening in airspace around them. And every one of the Middle Eastern countries that's been destabilized and toppled by the U.S. since 9/11 underwent a once-in-1,000-year drought. Is that a coincidence? I think not. In the case of California, we can see on satellite the aerosol operations happening off the coast that we know prohibit, they alter convection so it completely disrupts the normal hydrological cycle. And we have satellite imagery of that happening day in, day out. So we know this is a cause and effect scenario. There's no question. So on the fires, they've disrupted the hydrological cycle. And in fact, even though we had rain last year, Michael, you know how much they hyped up the rain in California last year, right? Or mm-hmm. during last winter. But we've had the longest, driest, hottest period on record since then. We had an unimaginably hot, dry summer. Fuel moistures here are all-time record lows in spite of the rain last year. We have geoengineering and the aerosol spraying I've spoke about. It ionizes the atmosphere, which makes it more electrically conductive. Thus, in the case of fires in general, like we've had on the West Coast, there's more dry lightning. We have, and this is another important aspect that people need to understand, it's an existential threat. Geoengineering is destroying the ozone layer. So that intense UV radiation is frying the trees in California, frying the foliage, frying the grass, makes everything unimaginably dry and flammable. We have an incendiary dust from climate engineering. That's inarguable because we have the lab test to prove it. Aluminum is an incendiary, so is barium, and when it's in dust form, that's coating the foliage. We have this same toxic metal in the rain that's been happening for overall on the planet for 7 decades, but very heavily since the year 2000 along the West Coast. And that saturates soils, killing the trees from the roots up. So from every direction, climate engineering is inarguably set the template for those fires to be as cataclysmic as they were. And even down to the surface winds that occurred that night, when climate engineering can so radically affect convection, that affects winds, which means they can control creating such a wind event as that which happened. So again, we cannot disconnect climate engineering with the ongoing global firestorm cataclysms. It must be considered a part of the equation.
There's a phenomenon that I've heard you refer to as a chemical ice nucleation. Now, like, what is that, and how is it being used?
In summary, with chemical ice nucleation for weather modification, that's patented technologies, the climate engineers can and are creating and engineering snowstorms. They're engineering winter. And for those who doubt this can be done, we even had Popular Science and Fox News cover the Chinese government's former open announcement that they were doing this process in China. Obviously, if the Chinese can do it, we can certainly do it. And your listeners can look this up online. If they search Fox News, Chinese scientists create engineer snowstorm, they'll find, again, Fox News and Popular Science. These are endothermic reacting materials that are sprayed into cloud moisture, water vapor rivers that chemically nucleate and form ice and absorb energy. And for those that are unfamiliar with these processes, we have lab tests at geoengineeringwatch.org. If they search geoengineeringwatch.org, chemical ice nucleation, they'll find a number of posts and articles with lab tests where a vessel of water has a few drops of biological and chemical nucleators added. It freezes that vessel instantly. So for people that really, Michael, for those who have a cold pack on their shelf somewhere in a first aid kit, you know you can mix those chemicals together, you have ice instantly.
Right, yeah.
Those who don't realize these technologies exist, they need to consider those basics. So on a massive scale, we have the chemical ice nucleating engineered events that are really the core cause of the massive weather whiplash. That's an important term, an important concept people need to remember. And Michael, you certainly have seen this happening, not just in our country, but elsewhere, these radical, radical temperature swings in the course of a day or less sometimes. You've watched this, correct?
Yeah, from heat to snow kind of thing?
Correct. And so to give specific examples, one I often use in Amarillo, Texas, May 1st, 2013, it was an all-time record high of 100 degrees on the ground. Official reading was 99, but ground readings were over 100. It snowed the next day. Now, we had, in the last 2 weeks in Texas, we've had parts of the state go from pushing 90 to snow in the northern part of the state, back up to pushing 100 in the upper 90s, back to snow. People should know this is absolutely not natural. And here's what we see. The chemical ice nucleation process creates a cold, dense layer of air that descends to the ground. Cold air is heavy. So we have a shallow layer of air at the ground that is much colder than the elevation higher up. In fact, we just got reports from pilots. They were seeing temperature changes of 25 to 30 degrees escalation at only 3,000 feet off the ground. How could you possibly have a 30-degree temperature rise 3,000 feet up? That's backwards. And we have pilots reporting to us right now that all they are seeing in altitude exclusively is positive temperature anomalies. It's hotter than it should be, far hotter. And that's all they see. They see nothing below normal anywhere they fly. And they're communicating directly with us. Gulfstream pilots, private pilots, some who fly very important people are communicating with us. We also have airline pilots communicating with us, and that's all they are seeing is positive temperature anomalies. So this is an attempt to confuse and divide the population as to the true state of the climate, and the engineered winter events are a part of that process. And Michael, have you noticed that a lot of the weathermen now, we don't really hear them referring to snow being at a certain elevation. It's just going to snow in a certain region, and you have the warm side of a winter storm and the cold side of a winter storm. Have you heard them refer to these terms?
Yeah, that sounds kind of familiar.
If those who watch Weather Channel will see this often. So instead of them saying snow elevations at such and such, you're either on the snowy side of the storm or the warm side of the storm. Since when do you have a winter storm with a warm and cold side? Remember, Michael, when Hurricane Sandy came in, it actually created snow further inland? Do you remember that?
I can't honestly say that.
It did.
Okay.
So think of a tropical hurricane creating snow. How does that happen? And many have reported they notice the different characteristics of the snow because it's not.
So you're saying the terminology has changed in recent years?
They make it up as they go, quite literally. They make it up as they go, just like they've named about a dozen and a half new cloud formations, as if those never existed before. Nobody noticed them. So as climate engineering is altering the atmosphere, they just put a name on it, and now it's...
Yeah. Could you comment a little bit more on you mentioned right at the outset of the failure to respond to these FOIA requests, but, you know, other ways in which the, people, these, authorities are suppressing these, this knowledge that you're putting forward?
Well, let's look at the state of California, who stopped testing for aluminum drinking water in 2002. Why would they do that? Let's look at particle testing. Air quality testing generally tests for PM10, 10 microns. Occasionally, they test for PM2.5. The smaller the particle, the more harmful it is. So none of their testing equipment is even capable of detecting this mountain of toxic metals that are floating down on us, which are nanoparticles. So they know this, and I've had a high-level meeting at in Sacramento with five top EPA people, closed-door meeting arranged by a congressional rep, where they told me to my face, the system is rigged. We're told to test for combustion particulates only of a particle size that's far bigger than what we know is in the atmosphere, and the rest of the sample goes out the window, literally. They throw it away. They discard it. If we look at, I spoke in front of the California Energy Commission in 2009 with their top scientist. I presented data to their top scientist there at that commission. The State Energy Commission authorized the purchase of a $200,000 spectrometer, which could determine the chemical composition and origin of these particulates in the atmosphere. That $200,000 unit has never been seen or heard from since that meeting. It's been rat-holed somewhere. So there's a very concerted effort to make sure this issue does not come to light. I've had private meetings with Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom in his office in the state capitol with his top aide. They acknowledged the data we presented. They could not dispute its authenticity. And yet they do nothing but try to hide this issue because their paychecks and pensions and perhaps much more depends on them hiding this issue. So what I would stress to listeners, again, this is not just another environmental issue. If we can't breathe without sucking in these materials, which we are all inhaling, we're all absorbing, it's being absorbed in the entire web of life, again, destroying the ozone layer. We have a NASA technician working with us right now, former NASA contract technician who metered ozone for NASA. And right now he's seeing depletion of what he estimates to be 75% ozone depletion in many areas. We're getting UVC on the surface. That's the last band of UV radiation before X-rays. It's a DNA damaging band. Mathematically, he gives us less than 10 years till total ozone layer collapse. Game over. So what I'm saying is from countless directions, climate engineering should be, must be, considered an existential threat to us all.
What do you make of some of the public statements that are debating whether or not geoengineering should be undertaken without acknowledging that it's been happening for 70 years or more, as you claim?
That's a total theater of mass deception. And it's interesting you would ask about that because we had House committee hearings on this yesterday with the usual cast of disinformation people present. And I'll have a post up on that with the contacts for those people later in the day today with the full video of the testimony. And this is nothing short of orchestrated mass public deception. Those in academia who are paid to pretend that climate engineering is only a proposal. And such people, I would argue, should be held, when we expose this issue, they should be held legally and morally accountable by a justifiably enraged population that understands that these people are literally helping to hide power structure crimes of not just genocide or ecocide, but omnicide. And so in our post, the contacts for these individuals who are acting in these massive plays of deception in House committee hearings, pretending climate engineering is just a proposal, they should be contacted by everyone of the public who's willing to help us in this battle and told, we know you know this is going on, and we will hold you legally and morally accountable once these crimes are exposed. So I would encourage people to consider that we have to shine the light on the individuals that are helping to carry out this mass public deception because they are no less than accomplices in the crime of criminal climate engineering.
I guess I only have time for one more question. Basically, I'm wondering if you could address the question of strategic mistakes for those people who have been, you know, I guess you'd say woken up to the reality of this phenomenon. Do you see them making certain mistakes over and over again that are counterproductive?
Yes, and I would start with this. Use the science terms. The chemtrails term is extremely counterproductive to our cause. I realize it's a term some people like. It's descriptive. It seems accurate. But there's no scientific basis to that term whatsoever. So when you introduce that term to someone and they go to search it online, all they find is conspiracy theory and hoax. In fact, even in a currently running FedEx commercial, there's a conspiracy bookstore in that commercial. In the background, there's a big conspiracy or chemtrails conspiracy theory, you know, public programming message. You know, that's one of the, again, your listeners might have seen that commercial that's running right now. So that's a term that's used to marginalize this issue. If you use the climate science terms, you use climate engineering, geoengineering, solar radiation management, use the science terms, pass on credible data. On the homepage of geoengineeringwatch.org, there's free downloadable files. So anyone, anywhere can print what we've already prepared, a 20-page full-color glossy booklet that you can share just the link for that. You don't even need to print or purchase anything in your own area or use our files to print anything. You can just use our link. It's filled with inarguable photos and data like the gag order on all the National Weather Service and NOAA employees, the document I spoke about, the 750-page Senate document, photographs of the nozzles. Share those with agencies, individuals, groups who would care if they saw credible data and were given the science terms. So in order to gain traction in this battle, we must do it effectively with credible data. That's what I would argue needs to be considered in sharing this issue, not just pointing at the sky, ranting, and using the non-science terms.
Okay. Well, I got to leave it there, but I want to thank you very much for spending the time to elaborate on this issue with our listeners.
Thank you for your work at Global Research and your for for your continued focus on this issue, Michael.
We've been speaking with Dane Wigington. He is the lead researcher for geoengineeringwatch.org, and he has spoke to us from his off-grid home in Shasta County, California.
There was mention in that last interview about deadly UV radiation entering the Earth's upper atmosphere, resulting in damage to living organisms on Earth. We'll close the show with part of an interview for the CKUW program, Where Angels Fear to Tread, that this broadcaster conducted on October 14th with a researcher formerly contracted by NASA. He has, since February of 2017, been monitoring dangerous UV radiation reaching the Earth's surface. Here are excerpts from that interview.
Intense UVB recently has been an issue with some of the photosynthesis process in plant life. But as far as humans go, it's the UVC region, and in specific, the 270 nanometer. And this is what I focused my study on, 270 nanometers, because it is resonant with all DNA RNA. In other words, it's like a tuning fork at those frequencies. You hit that tuning fork with a certain intensity, and if that tuning fork is at the same frequency as your DNA RNA, it literally vibrates the chains apart, causing DNA damage. The bottom of my green on the charts, on the surface plots, the bottom of the green represents that 0.8 microwatts per square centimeter, which is the maximum industry standard for radiation exposure at that frequency. Well, I've had peaks up to 1.7. And what this means basically is if you go out into the sun, say we're at 1 microwatt, at 1 microwatt worth of radiation, you can withstand about 37 minutes of solar radiation before you're going to incur damage. And in the old days when we had a healthy ozone layer, you know, you go into the sun, you get hot, and then you go into the shade and cool off a little bit and then back into the sun. Well, if you've been into the sun for 40 minutes, you go into the shade to cool off. If you go back into the sun, the damage you get to your DNA is going to be exponentially higher because your body has not had the chance to heal from the first radiation exposure.
The website for Ray, the researcher you just heard, can be found at the URL irary2017.wixsite.com/sacredseeds. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com.